Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. Little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor yourself, please go to the website bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the link to become a Patreon sponsor. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And I am just back from Maui, Hawaii. I just got back yesterday. So I was out there for a week on vacation with my family, had a great time. And it was really a wonderful experience. If you've ever been to Maui or Hawaii in general, it's just so beautiful out there. It really is like paradise. So this was my second time going in the last few years. I went out the last time in 2020, January of 2020, right before COVID started. So I haven't been out there since. So it was great going out there. My brother was out there with his family and my mom and dad. And so it was really a great time. So anyways, we did not get a chance to do an interview for the show. But what I thought we would do for this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, we've never done this before, but I thought I would spend the whole episode just reading old bodybuilding magazine articles. And as you know, at the end of each show, we usually read one or sometimes two magazine articles. So I figured since we didn't have any guests this week, we will probably have Jerry Branham on again next week to talk about the year 1992, where we continue our year-end review. And that will be a two-part interview. But I didn't get a chance to interview Jerry last week before I left. So I will probably do that this week, and then we'll have that interview up next week. But in the meantime, I thought I would read some old articles. So I've got some about five different articles here. So if you guys like hearing the articles, this show is for you. I'm going to read one from 1977, which was the IFBB Mr. Universe that year. And that was the one where Danny Padilla won his class over Muhammad Mukawe. And Roy Callender won the middleweight class. And the controversial Cal Scalak beating Mike Mentzer in the heavyweight class. And this was written by Jack Neary, one of the best writers for Muscle Builder. So that will be the first one I'm going to read. I'm also going to read an article about Rachel McLish, which was written by Rick Wayne in a 1984 issue of Muscle and Fitness. A few weeks ago, or maybe a month or so ago, I read part one of the 1983 Mr. Olympia report in Munich, Germany that Samir Banoot won. That was written by Rick Wayne. We never got a chance to read part two, so I'm going to read part two. Arnold did a really great interview with Muscle and Fitness right before Conan was released. This was in 1981. Right after the controversial 1981 Mr. Olympia that Arnold produced with Jim Lorimer. So I'm going to read part one of that interview. And then I also have another article that I never got around to reading. It was sent to me by one of our listeners for the show, Matthew Collinson. And it's about the 1987 Grand Prix, the Detroit Grand Prix that was won by Mike Ashley. This was Mike Ashley, I believe, only win. I'm sorry. He also won the Arnold Classic, of course. But this was Mike's win in 1987, where he beat Ron Love and Shane DeMora and Mike Quinn. But it was also the last contest for Tom Platz, 1987 Detroit Grand Prix, where Tom got sixth. So this was written by Gary Bartlett. So I never read this article before, so I'm going to read this. This should be really interesting. This was kind of a smaller contest that's not really talked about, but as Matthew told me when he sent this to me, this was the last contest for Tom Platz, so it's pretty memorable. All right. I didn't have any emails for this week, of course. Last week I was out in Hawaii and didn't have any emails about the last show we did with Jerry, which was about 1982. I did get a chance to visit Mario Saline's gym, which is called Reps. So if you're ever out in Maui, check out Reps Gym. It's just a personal training studio, really. It's owned by Mario and Hanu, her husband. Very, very nice people. I got to go over there and go out to have coffee with Hanu and catch up with him. So they have been out there for 30 years. They are from Finland originally. And for those of you that don't know, Mario Saline was one of the premier women bodybuilders in the 1980s. She was actually in the movie Pumping Iron 2. And beautiful, beautiful lady. And she still looks fantastic. She's in her 60s. I'm not sure how old Hanu is. I think he's probably in his late 60s as well. So we got a chance to visit with them, and hopefully I'll be going out to Maui again before 3 years, because it's a great place to visit, man. I could go out there every year for sure. What else is going on in the world of bodybuilding? Oh, the big news is the Arnold Classic that's coming up. I believe that will be the weekend of March 3rd and 4th in Columbus, Ohio again. And Arnold is promoting it with his new partner. So I think Brian Powers is the guy that's helping to run it. But anyways, they had a very small list of competitors. And I'm sure that was because the Olympia was just in December. And a lot of people felt it was just too close and it just wasn't worth it to get in shape for that. So they raised the prize money. I believe they were now up to $300,000 for first place. So now they are getting lots of bodybuilders. Nick Walker, who was third place at the Olympia, he is going in it. Nick won the Arnold Classic, not last year, but the year before. And Andrew Jacked, who is a great new bodybuilder, he took, I believe, eighth place at the Olympia. So he's coming back. He looks fantastic. So he will be in his first Arnold Classic. In fact, Andrew got his pro card by winning the Arnold Classic Amateur. And he's only been a pro for about maybe a year or two. So he looks really great. We also have Samson Dauda, who really made a big splash at the Olympia. He was in sixth place, but a lot of people felt he could have even placed higher. So he's going to be a real dark horse. Sean Clarita, who won the 212 Olympia, he is going in it. So Sean could be right up there. He could beat a lot of the big guys. He is always in top shape. So that'll be interesting to see. Unfortunately, Derek Lunsford is not going in it. We were hoping that he was going to do it. But it was just announced just a few days ago that Big Rami, two-time Mr. Olympia winner, is going into the Arnold Classic. Rami got fifth place at this year's Olympia. He was dethroned and dropped all the way down to fifth place. A lot of people thought he was done. Some people didn't even know if he's ever going to compete again. But we thought maybe he would be at the Olympia next year. And now he has announced that he is going to go into the Arnold Classic. So this is going to be really interesting how the judges are going to look at his physique. I don't know if he is placing lower in this last Olympia because he just didn't hit his peak or because he's got some damage to his physique. A lot of people have speculated he's got nerve damage and his back doesn't look the same and his tricep doesn't look the same. If that's the case, it's probably not going to change much between December and March. But it's possible that maybe he just wasn't peaked enough. And I think that's what he's implying. And his coaches, Chad Nichols, is saying the same thing. So we will see what happens with Big Rami going in it against Nick Walker and Andrew Jack and Samson Dauda. A lot of people thought Samson Dauda could have beat Rami at the Olympia. So this is a big risk for Rami, and we'll see what happens and what kind of shape he looks like. But it's turning out to be a great contest coming up. I don't think I'll be there this year. I don't have any plans to go. It's the week before my big birthday, so I'm not sure if I'm going to go. And I just spent a whole week out in Maui, so I want to get back on my diet and get in shape. I want to get really ripped for this year. I don't think I'm going to make it by March, but hopefully by April or May, I'll be in really top condition. So I don't have any plans to go, but I'll probably check it out on pay-per-view. But regardless, it's going to be a pretty exciting show. The other big news in the bodybuilding world this last week is Michael Hearn, Natural Mr. Universe winner. Like myself, Mike won it in 1997, and Mike has been trying to make it in the movies for a long time. He's been appearing in television shows and movies for probably, I would say, the last 30 years. It's always been a big passion of Mike's. Mike is now 54 years old. He will be 54 this month if he hasn't already turned 54. I think his birthday is in January. I'm not sure when it is. But anyways, Mike has now got a big role in a movie that's coming out that's getting a lot of buzz. It's called Magazine Dreams. It was just premiered this last weekend at the Sundance Film Festival, which is one of the bigger film festivals of the year. And I guess what the movies do is any new movies that come out, they will show them at the Sundance Film Festival, and they'll try to get distributors. They'll try to get movie production companies or maybe streaming services. Somebody will buy the film, and then they will distribute it. So this film got a lot of great reviews. I read all the reviews over the weekend on Rotten Tomatoes, of course, and got like a 90% positive review. So the buzz around the movie is the actor in the movie, Jonathan Majors, who has been in quite a few movies over the last couple of years, but they said he is just absolutely fantastic. The writer and director is Elijah Bynum. So Jonathan Majors plays a bodybuilder, and his name is Killian Maddox. And the whole story is about bodybuilding. Killian wants to be a bodybuilder. He idolizes Michael Hearn, who plays a bodybuilder named Brad Vanderhorn, I believe. Mike's character is in the magazines, and Killian wants to be just like him. So he writes letters to Mike. But Killian is going through a lot of things. He's very disturbed. A lot of the critics have compared the movie to Taxi Driver. He's going to therapy. He's got anger issues. And he's like literally destroying himself through bodybuilding just to make it and be on top or be in the magazines and be noticed. So it sounds like a very disturbing movie. Some of the reviews I read compared it to The Joker with Joaquin Phoenix, which was also a very disturbing movie. But anyways, it sounds like a great movie. It's gotten great reviews. And it is definitely a major movie, probably the biggest one that Michael Hearn has ever appeared in. So congratulations to Michael Hearn. I know he's been doing this for a long time, and he's never given up. And now he's 54 years old, and he's probably made the biggest movie of his life. And so this may lead to bigger things. You never know. I mean, when you get a movie like this that gets a lot of attention and a lot of people see it, and who knows, even Jonathan Powers might even get nominated for an Academy Award next year for his role in this movie. I mean, that's how great it sounds like he was in the movie. So you never know. I mean, it might bring a lot of attention to this movie. So congratulations to Michael Hearn. I heard on his Facebook page that he's going to be in like three other movies this year. So he's got four movies coming out this year. So good for him. Glad to see that. And I hope things work out for him in the movie industry. But I really can't wait to see this movie. I don't know if you can see it now. I don't think so, because they just had it at the film festival. But hopefully sometime later this year, it'll either be at the theaters or it will be at a streaming service. So I'll let you guys know when I find out about that. All right. So that's the latest in the news. So right now I'm going to go ahead and start reading these articles. I've got like five of them. So if you guys are into this stuff and you want to hear some articles, this is the show for you. All right, so this first article is about the 1987 IFBB Detroit Grand Prix, and this was Tom Platz's last competition. And from the pictures in this article, he looks really great. He looks in great shape. The title of the article is called Requiem for a Superstar, and it's written, and the photos are by Gary Bartlett. And it said, did the IFBB Pro Invitational in Detroit witness the last competitive appearance of Tom Platz? 1981 Revisited. On October 10, 1981, at the Veterans Memorial Auditorium, Columbus, Ohio, Tom Platz brushed bodybuilding immortality with one of the most awesome physiques in bodybuilding history. As Tom walked on stage, you could hear the gasp of amazement. He was astounding. In spite of the almost grotesque leg development, his upper body was equally as absurd. The massive and vascular torso defied the imagination. Almost all parties in the press section stared in disbelief at this muscular transformation. His upper torso, although still not quite up to the phenomenal legs, was still as close as any mortal could get, considering the proportions of those inhuman tree trunks. Yes, Tom Platz had finally met the challenge of taming and forging his upper body in conquest over those awesome thighs. Unfortunately, Tom had conquered himself, the Columbus audience, and the press, but he failed to win over the judges. In a very bitter and controversial decision, Tom was given third place behind less than spectacular Franco Colombo and Chris Dickerson. Even though Tom was not given the Mr. Olympia crown, in everyone's mind, he was the winner. So was born the legend of the Golden Eagle. Following 1981, Tom was besieged with offers to guest pose and perform seminars. He was advertised as the uncrowned Mr. Olympia. It was only a matter of time before he would win the title. The year 1982 would be Tom's year. He would devote the entire year to bringing his already awesome development into even higher standards. It was everyone's opinion that Tom would take the Olympia crown in London, England. Contest time approached, and then tragedy struck. As Tom was performing a set of lying dumbbell flies, his right bicep snapped and literally rolled up his arm. The pain and distortion of the arm was unbearable for Tom. Troubled by the fact that he would not be able to compete in London and would let down his many fans, he made a drastic mistake which would alter his destiny in bodybuilding from there on. Instead of immediately going to the hospital to have his injured bicep repaired, he continued to train through the pain. His idea was to compete and then have the torn bicep repaired later. Tom did go to London, and it was obvious that his bicep was well off the development of the other. The result was a lower placing and a series of lower placings in many Olympias after. Regardless of his Olympia finishes, Tom's legend and popularity continued unhindered. He became one of the most sought-after guest posers, and his business sense helped to promote his image even more. Regardless of all the financial success and popularity, a fierce fire burned deeply in Tom's heart. He desperately wanted that Olympia title. Sadly, not all stories end with a happy ending. In Tom's case, he finished out of the top 10 in the 86 Olympia. The result of his low placing was that he would not be automatically invited to the 87 event in Sweden. The only way that Tom would qualify to compete in Sweden was to place in the top three of any IFBB professional show. Since Tom failed to compete in the 87 New York Night of the Champions or the World Pro, he would have to find another contest or forget his dream of the Olympia. Detroit calling. It seems that Tom's prayers were answered, as there would be an IFBB professional bodybuilding event to be held in August 15th in Detroit City. Rumors were circulating that the entire reason this event was being staged was to give Platts an opportunity to make the top three and qualify for the Olympia. In fact, information regarding the event, which was to be called the IFBB 1987 Men's Pro Invitational, was very sketchy. It was only during the week before the contest that I could find out who was actually competing and if the event was on or not. Judging from the limited lineup, it looked like Tom Platts was sure to finish in the top three. Having been to many places around the world in the past 10 years to report bodybuilding events, I can honestly say that Detroit is the worst city I have ever been in. The streets are deserted and the buildings are in a state of falling down. What people are on the streets, you would not want to know. There are a few nice spots in the city, but they are rare. Arriving at the Hotel St. Regis, it was evident that this would not be the biggest bodybuilding event of the season. It was very hard to locate anyone who might be working on the contest. In all, we would only see 9 contestants on stage for the prejudging. Scott Wilson was scheduled to compete, but he got delayed at Chicago Airport, which was flooded out. As we entered Detroit Masonic Auditorium, I was beginning to wonder if the public was aware of the event, as there were very few spectators at the afternoon prejudging. Although the lineup lacked quantity, it made up for it in quality. Judging from the conditions of Shane DeMora, newcomer Mike Quinn, Mike Ashley, and Detroit's own Ron Love, it looked like Platts had his work cut out. Other competitors were Canada's Wayne Robbins, Charles Glass, Ali Mala, and John Brown. It was immediately clear that Wayne Robbins did not belong in the lineup. Obviously, he felt that way also as he failed to appear at the evening competition. John Brown, who's known for his long posing routines, displayed a very prominent torn pec, which hindered his appearance considerably. John would not be taking home any top placing today. Earlier, I had a chance to talk with Ali Mala when he told me that he was training drug-free. Ali felt that he was much more ripped and at least 20 pounds lighter than he was at the Night of the Champions. Judging from his condition, it was clear that Ali was correct. However, he seemed to lack density. He was cut and appeared less bloated and vascular than in the past, but he failed to really display any great amount of improvement. The famous Mala biceps were still impressive, and his waist appeared non-existent, but nothing spectacular enough to win favor with the IFBB judges. An ultra-ripped Charles Glass was evidently considering upsetting a few egos, as he was in the best shape of his pro career. When Charles hit a side chest pose, it appeared as though his muscles were about to explode through his tight skin. During the prejudging, it was hard to tell just where the judges felt Platts belonged. He was called out on a number of occasions for comparisons. However, as the day wore on, it was obvious that the comparisons were not intended to place Platts in the top three. Tom's condition was up to the best that I've seen in recent Olympias. His thighs were separated and striated with stunning calves. His back was wide and deeply cut. The only weakness, of course, was in his arms. I found that even his good biceps seemed to lack density and mass, while the torn one really was small. In spite of this, his abs were sharp and the pecs were full and well-rounded. As the brief prejudging wore on, it was clear that Quinn, Love, DeMora, and Ashley had full intentions of bringing down the Golden Eagle. How unfortunate that Tom Platts' possibly last competition would be in front of a mere audience of only 300 fans. On a guest posing exhibition, Tom can pull in literally thousands of fans in less than his best condition. Today, in his best condition, he had to perform to an empty theater. The first poser of the competition was the current IFBB superstar Mike Ashley, who recently finished second at the 87 Night of the Champions in New York. Judging from Mike's superb condition, it was obvious he had not let himself get out of shape since New York. The famous Ashley Washboard abs were sharp and appeared etched in granite. Mike was ripped, especially in the upper torso, with spectacular biceps peaked to the hilt. Mike was one competitor that Tom Platz would not touch. Florida's bouncy Shane DeMora was determined to prove that his condition in New York was only a timing error on his part, and that the 20-year-old kid could turn pro and take on the big boys. And take on the big boys he did, as Shane, shedding several pounds of excess water since New York, revealed a polished and ripped condition, which had the judges taking a second look. Shane presented a super posing routine which accented his superb condition beautifully. His thighs were striated and deeply separated, with his upper torso thick and neatly defined. Shane sports an ultra-wide back, which makes his development even more spectacular. His only weakness is his arms, which require more size to balance off his thicker upper torso and awesome thighs. I've seen Detroit's own hometown champion Ron Love compete on many occasions, and the man's always in superb shape. Ron recently won the 87 IFBB World Pro Championships in Germany. Throughout the entire day, Ron was fired up. He was in his hometown, and he had the taste of victory still in his blood from earlier in the year. This would be a good event for him to win, and he was determined to do just that. As Ron was about to present his routine in the evening, an unfortunate error may have cost him the title. The tape, which was played for him, was not his. To make things worse, the sound went out for a number of seconds, which left Ron posing on one side of the podium in less than spectacular presentation. In discussing this with Ron after the competition, he was upset, but he did not feel it sportsmanlike to have walked off the stage. Ron's condition was reasonably sharp, although he seemed to have lost a bit of the thick density in New York. Ron had the most amazing delt development and massive upper torso in the entire lineup, but he still requires more thickness and shape in his legs. Perhaps one of the highlights of the competition was the onslaught of the Mighty Quinn. Defecting from competing in the NABBA and WABA competitions, Mike Quinn decided to give his IFBB Pro ranks a fair try. Mike has won several titles in the NABBA and WABA, and like many other frustrated bodybuilders, found that he had no place to go except to continue to compete in the same events year after year with little financial reward. The Fly Quinn knew that he could place in the top three of the Detroit event, he would have a free ride to the Olympia. To say the least, Mike was awesome. His bulk and mass dominated the podium, especially in the comparison rounds. No one else could match up to his huge proportions. Mike displayed huge melon-sized pecs, delts, and upper back. His only weakness was in the calves, where he requires more size. Mike also appeared to be holding a bit of water, resulting in a slightly smooth appearance. Had he been 5 pounds lighter, he would have pulled off an upset. Nevertheless, the Mighty Quinn presented a formidable package, and he will be trouble for the established IFBB pros in future events. What can be said of the legendary posing presentation of the Golden Eagle, Tom Platz? This man combines more spirit, charisma, gut-wrenching emotion, and pure showmanship than any other bodybuilder. Tom loves his fans, and he gives them every bit of his soul when posing. In spite of a mere audience of 300, Tom presented one of the best performances of his competitive career. Perhaps sensing that this may be his last pro contest, he would leave with his head in the air and competitive spirit intact. Standing with his ultra-wide back to the audience and posing to Christopher Cross's Ride Like the Wind, Tom slowly turned his head to one side and began his routine with his now famous wink to the audience. Hitting one classic pose after another, and all the time smiling and winking, Tom had the Detroit audience eating out of his hand. Then switching to a faster, more upbeat pace of music, Tom exploded into several more poses in a row. Finally, he ran to the front of the stage and he hit his famous striated thigh pose for the elated fans. Ending his routine with a wave and a kiss to the crowd, I got the feeling that this is the last time we will see the Golden Eagle in competition. If this is so, this performance was double-edged in that it was an inspiring but a sad and unruling tribute to one of bodybuilding's finest competitors. The only place that could do Tom's last performance justice would be the packed arena in Sweden at the Mr. Olympia. The climax of the competition came in the announcement of a top five finalist: Charles Glass, Mike Quinn, Shane DeMora, Ron Love, and Mike Ashley. So sadly, and to much everyone's surprise, Tom Platz did not make the top five. I personally felt he should have been in fifth place, as his condition was superior to Glass's, who was much smaller and less spectacular than Tom. Platz would have to suffer the ultimate disappointment of his career, to place lower than men who were not even training when he was in his glory year of 1981, when he had defeated the best in the world. In an effort to finish the event with a bang, top IFBB official Wayne D'Amelio felt it would be a good idea to encourage the finalists to conduct the final pose down right down in the aisles of the theater to really give the audience a close-up view of what the world's best bodybuilders really look like. As each champion made his way from the stage to down among the fans, all hell broke loose as Love hit his best, most muscular pose, only to be matched by Mike Ashley's version. Not to be outdone, the young Demora jumped in and hit his best shot. The audience loved this as they screamed at the top of their lungs with approval. First, the finalists posed on one side of the theater, and then they crossed in front of the judges' table to the other side. The frantic series of muscular poses again transpired. Finally, the judges reached their decision. First place, Mike Ashley. Second, Shane D'Amora. Third, a very disappointed Ron Love. Fourth, Mike Quinn. Fifth, Charles Glass. In discussing the placings with several knowledgeable press people following the contest, it seems that most were surprised to see Tom finish out of the fifth place. Most agreed with Ashley first and the rest of the placings. As for Platts, it was obvious by his attitude that he was not happy at all with his finish. He stormed back to the hotel and to his room without making any comments. His absence at the post-contest party was noted. Tom was in no mood to discuss his feelings with the general public at this time. It would be a very rare individual indeed to be able to control the tremendous disappointment he must have felt. Where does Tom go from here? Well, judging from the reception that he received at the hotel desk the following morning after the competition, I would say that he still has plenty of fans. In fact, I understand that Tom has a tremendous number of guest posing exhibitions scheduled from now until late fall. What this adds up to is a lot of money for the Golden Eagle. Goes to show that that legends never die. You remain a champ as long as you remain loyal to your fans. This has been the secret of Tom's success all through his career. He has never let down his fans nor forgotten them. The Golden Eagle soars on. In the 1987 IFBB Pro Invitational final placings, Mike Ashley first, Shane D'Amora second, Ron Love third, Mike Quinn fourth, Charles Glass fifth, Tom Platts was sixth, Ali Mala seventh, John Brown eighth, and Wayne Robbins from Canada in ninth. All right. Thank you very much to our friend Matthew Collinson for sending me that article, and great article by Gary Bartlett, who we've had on the show. Gary used to write for Muscle Mag. I'm not sure what magazine this article appeared in, but this was a notable contest because it was the pro debut of Shane D'Amora and also the pro debut of Mike Quinn. And looking at the pictures right now from this article, they both looked awesome. I was always a big fan of Mike Quinn, and he was in unbelievable shape. In fact, Mike entered the show right after he got his pro card at the 87 USA, which was held in July, and this was only a couple weeks later in August. So Mike just jumped into the very first pro show he could do. He was not qualified for the Olympia because he didn't make the top three, but he did make the Olympia next year in 1988, where he placed sixth, and that was his top Olympia placing ever. Shane D'Amora, unfortunately, at only 20 years old, I forgot Shane was only 20, he did not go very far in the sport because he tore his pec, and he got his pro card at 19 years old. He won the 1986 Junior Nationals in the middleweight class. He didn't win the overall. Eddie Robinson won the overall, but he won the middleweights on the same night that he won the Teenage Nationals. And then he went to the Nationals later that year that was won by Gary Stridham, but Shane won the middleweight class. And from what I read, it was kind of close between him and Stridham. Shane actually got a couple first place votes. And then this was 1 year later when Shane was only 20 and he got second place in this contest, beating out Mike Quinn and beating out Ron Love, as well as, of course, Tom Platts. And then Mike Ashley had just taken second, as the article said, in the Night of the Champions to Gary Stridham. So this was only a couple months later, and he was in fantastic shape. Mike was an amazing bodybuilder. And then Ron Love looked really good at the Olympia that year in Sweden, Ron Love. In fact, I remember seeing it on pay-per-view, and I thought Ron should have did a lot better. But great article. Thank you, Gary Bartlett, for that great article. And thanks to Matthew Collinson again for sending that to us. All right, my next one is going to go 10 years back, and we're going to go to the 1977 IFBB World Championships. And this comes from the March 1978 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. This was before it was Muscle and Fitness. And it's written by one of our favorite writers, along with Rick Wayne, of course, Mr. Jack Neary. Says the 1977 IFBB World Bodybuilding Championships Padilla, Callender, and Scalac triumph in Nîmes, France. It's the week after the 1977 IFBB World Bodybuilding Championships at Nîmes, France. The three new world champions are home, probably sleeping. Lightweight class champion Danny Padilla in Rochester, New York. Middleweight class winner Roy Callender in Montreal. And the heavyweight champion Cal Scalac in Santa Monica, California. Each man in the dreamy depths of an all-encompassing slumber of satisfaction, able to finally succumb to our latest technological sedative, jet lag. That even with a good 3 days of plastic American culture back under the belt, still plays havoc with the mind's clockwork. After having skipped across the Atlantic twice in 9 days, there and back, one's perception of time has been so thoroughly distorted that continual midday nod-offs have created a legitimate fear. It's now not uncommon to drop off in the late afternoon, which can be dangerous because at that time, one is usually at the wheel of a car tooling down a clogged multi-lane strip of cement. Exactly 1 week after Scalac upset favorite Mike Mentzer for the heavyweight title, Ken Waller, the Marshal of Mirth, threw a victory bash in honor of the champion. Of the 30 people there, only three had made the trip overseas. Scalac, of course, his wife Joan, and Jack Neary, the troublemaker from Muscle Builder magazine. Even at the early 4 or 5 p.m., the three were still stifling yawns, jet lag still hounding their concentration. It is suspected, however, that Scalac, of ferocious appetite and proclaimed love of gluttony, may have combined those wide, teary yawns with the frequent shoveling of ice cream, pizza, and a king's ransom of homemade macaroons, cheesecake, pie, and cookies, all washed down with golden streams of brew. In the short while the Scalacs have been back home, Joan has spent most of it before the yawning jaws of a hot oven, pulling out a batch of cookies and putting in another of the forbidden fruit. It was evident from the impressive array of goodies that covered an 8-foot-long table in Waller's kitchen that it wouldn't be long before Scalac's ripped-to-ribbons body would be cloaked in his old uniform of subcutaneous fat. Between bites and sips and accepting repeated felicitations from his guests, Scalac wore an ear-to-ear, crumb-flecked grin that suggested the total and final satisfaction of winning his class in the top amateur contest, a contest for which he has had to eschew this sort of eating for over 2 months, which in itself may have been as grueling a task as the very battle in Nîmes. What a battle it was. It is unknown if Scalac ever conceded it as so, but Mentzer was the favorite to win the heavyweight class. After having placed second to Robbie Robinson the year before in Montreal, it seemed a certainty that 1977 was Mentzer's year, his turn. At least it kept with the trend of the heavyweight winners in the past few years. One had to lose before winning, and adhering with the unwritten canon of competition, Mentzer had paid his dues with the loss to Robinson. Many weeks before, what reason to be fact, Neary had added to the byline of Mentzer's articles from Muscle Builder, World Bodybuilding Champion 1977, a presumptuous grouping of words indeed, that it would appear just so in issues after the contest, after Scalac had been awarded the title. In Neary's presence sometime after, Scalac would read Mentzer's byline, but make no issue of it, for in talking of his victory, he would say, "I pulled an upset. I was as shocked as Mike when my name was called. I really didn't know if I had won." But on another occasion following the contest, Scalac would visit Neary in his office in Wiederland, where Neary was preparing an outline for the story. Neary had jotted something about a prejudging controversy, and upon reading this, Scalac asked, "You aren't going to make a controversy out of the prejudging, are you?" And a subtle reminder that he would not appreciate being discredited for his victory. "No," Neary would say, "I won't make a controversy out of it. There already is a controversy. I'll just explain what happened." The tension there burned off quickly. No one wished a flare-up on these terms. Scalac and Neary were friends. There was no mistaking Neary's happiness for Cal. It was an issue out of their hands, and Mentzer's too. The judges' score sheets show that Mentzer scored 279 points from the prejudging, Scalac with 269, a considerable margin. After an hour and a half of deliberate comparison over three rounds of judging, relaxed, mandatory, and optional posing, seven men who pride themselves on their objectivity established in all rounds that Mentzer had the superior physique. Yes, a 10-point difference would seem to indicate that. Neary didn't have the chance to talk with Scalac after the prejudging that cloudy Sunday afternoon in the south of France. It had been a long morning, the prejudging having started at 7 a.m. Both grumbling stomachs and a need for rest sent most of the athletes to their rooms after the prejudging. It would only be a few hours until the evening contest. Mentzer's attitude was one of supreme confidence after the morning test. One judge approached him to assure him of his victory, and this made for a deep warmth of elation in Mentzer's gut. I knew I had it when they called out Cal, Paul Grant, and Alos Peck for comparison, but left me out, said Mentzer that afternoon. That was an indication that they were considering me as the best, and now they were picking for second and third. The evening contest proved to be the crux of the competition. In the morning, during the optional posing round, Skalak received the more enthusiastic ovation from the crowd by virtue of the presentation of his awesome upper body. In the relaxed round, Mentzer had been anything but relaxed. At times, he would even break into posing, even pointing at his huge calves, the body part that most thought would spell the difference between he and Skalak. Mentzer's aggressive, albeit illegal, flexing drew a mild warning from judging coordinator Dennis Stallar. It was all taken with a rather good nature. Mentzer's face held an impish smile, and even after the warning, he continued to twist and contort and make damn sure everyone saw his calves. Had he been standing beside Skalak in the lineup, it would have come as no surprise if he pointed to his opponent's less developed calves and then back at his own. Skalak had the crowd yelling even louder at night. It was hard to imagine that mere weeks before he was dubbed King of the Smoothies. Now he could hold his own with the most defined of bodybuilders, his back the quintessence of ripdom. Mentzer's ovation was more inspiring that evening also. His posing, never his strong point, was smooth and controlled, and the cheering French let it be known that they were impressed. The evening pose down was usually for the benefit of the crowd to give it a taste of the prejudging comparison. Grant joined Skalak and Mentzer, and for the first few minutes, the pose down carried on normally, each man hitting a series of his best shots, perhaps getting a little hyper near the end, and the pitch in the place rose higher as the bodybuilders posed faster. The pose down had stretched on long enough that it seemed, and Oscar State, who had been timing, sounded the buzzer. Each competitor hurriedly got in an extra pose or two after the buzzer and then stopped. The three big men were soaked with sweat and puffing hard, obviously relieved that the thing was over. But the crowd kept on with its spirited cheering. All it took was a slight movement from Skalak to set everyone off again. It got so that you could see each man laboring with his poses, fatigue so fierce that they could hardly flex. Later, Skalak would say, "I was glad when the pose down ended the first time. I was so tired. I couldn't see what Mike was doing. He was on the other side of Paul Grant. But in the corner of my eye, I could see movement, and I thought he was posing again. So boom, I started up too. Geez, I thought we'd never end." A combination of State's buzzing and pure fatigue drew the contest to an end. The curtains closed for about 30 seconds as a large marching band took position on the stage. The winner would not be without his fanfare. Behind the curtain, the three competitors stood waiting for the band to get set up so that once and for all, they could know who won. They made small talk about how tired they were. Presently, the curtains parted and the band struck up with a rousing tune, lots of brass and bass. Skalak seemed unnaturally calm, even jovial. He began bouncing and swaying to the rhythm of the music. Smiling all the way, even enjoying himself, Skalak's ebullience seemed contagious. Mentzer and Grant began smiling, trying like hell to look as if they too were enjoying themselves. Even during a time when the heart most certainly must have raced and the suspense formed an acidic knot within the gut. But then Skalak had displayed consistent calm throughout the day. Before the prejudging in the room that the athletes were to pump up in, Skalak was staggering around pretending he was drunk from the many liters of bottled Perrier water he had been drinking since he arrived in France. "Hick," he gurgled, crazy Guggenheim style, "this stuff's got a real kick." And when he wasn't acting drunk, he was doing Jack Benny imitations. Now here was seconds before the biggest moment of his bodybuilding career, and he was actually getting into the marching music that was flooding his senses from behind. What Neary had been unaware of was that the evening pose down was judged, that it would be the final round. Neary was under the impression that it was merely for show, that the contest had already been decided. Later, Mentzer would admit that he did not know the evening pose down was being judged. Now, of course, everybody knew the results from the prejudging, even though it was revealed after the contest that Mentzer scored 10 more points than Skalak, which contradicted the final decision, and here the controversy dwells. Not a soul in the house knew anything about point accumulations. Just as nobody knew that until it was announced that Cal Skalak was the new world heavyweight champion which when it was uttered by a stunned Oscar State, came down like a freaking surprise. At first, Neary thought it was the microphone static that blurred the name he had expected to hear. But as Skalak hopped onto the victory podium and raised his massive arms overhead to greet the deluge of noise that came tumbling down from the furthest of seats, it was certain that he had heard right. The king of the smoothies was simply the king. It was bedlam backstage. Skalak was almost incoherent from joy, but he struggled through the first of many interviews with a cabal of media people. Menser wandered around with a pained look in his eyes. He had never expected this, not after victory seemed so sure. Already, Oscar State, Ben Weider, and Dennis Stallard had approached him to say they were going to check into the score sheets, that there may have been a mistake. Roy Callender, who had already been named the middleweight champion, sat in a small anteroom with Canadian teammate Henry Calker. Neary had not seen Callender since his triumph, and having been a friend of Roy's for a few years, rushed in to congratulate him. "Thank you," said Callender, humbly, and there is so little left of that in bodybuilding. "But I cannot feel happy right now, not after what just happened to Mike. I can't believe it. Just don't talk to me." "The real outrage," snorted Calker, "was the decision for third place. How the hell can they give it to Paul Grant today, and yesterday in the European Championships, the Czech, Alois Peck, beats him?" Indeed, that was an issue given little thought. Peck, a tall champion from Czechoslovakia with huge arms, had beaten Grant for the heavyweight class of the European Championships the day before. Now this reversal. But in the presence of the Skalak-Menser controversy, it paled. Boyer Coe, the great professional, had been in Menser's corner since he had arrived in Nimes. He approached Menser backstage and said, "Well, Mike, the only thing I can say is that sometimes a guy gets into a fight and he fights his heart out and he knows he won the thing, but somebody tells him he didn't. I know how you feel." Much later, after the huge banquet which much of the town attended, Menser's girlfriend Kathy and Neary lamented over the curious situation of the point totals. The pall of gloom emanating from Menser and this methodic sobbing from his major life force and confidant Kathy made for as bleak a scene as one would encounter in a musty volume of Poe. It began to get existential. Menser seemed to mistake shock for a lack of concern, but he would feel the brunt of the defeat hours later after an all-night ride on a packed train from Nimes to Nice. "For some reason, I just can't get too excited about this whole thing," he said. He was lying prone on a bed and scanned the cottage cheese ceiling with a vacant stare. Kathy was at his side, somewhere deep into a blue funk. "Maybe it just hasn't hit me, but how can I take the opinions of men with pencils in their hands seriously?" Neary, rabid rambler that he is, had something to say on the matter. "When you really think of it, what is bodybuilding? You have this long lineup of huge guys, guys who spent much of their lives in a gym with iron barbells and equipment, and they've tortured themselves to build all this mass, and now they stand on a stage somewhere far from home and parade around, and some man half his size has a pencil and makes a few marks on a paper and decides which body's the best. Yes, a lineup of men as close to physical perfection as man can get. People looked at us as Greek gods from the pantheon. Men with huge followings, revered as idols. In the eyes of the masses, they are heaven personified. And then a group of other men called judges, more or less mortals when you think of it, come along and they topple the celestial pedestals these gods rest upon. One physique contest and it can all come crashing down to reality. I guess even gods are mortal sometimes. And the crazy thing is that a decision from a complete stranger affects the bodybuilder's whole life. Dreams are made or broken by the pencil marks of a guy's observations. You have to ask yourself, who sets the standard for which these bodies are judged? I mean, who says that big calves and a small waist is the look? How do we know that someday maybe it won't change? It all becomes so damn impersonal, doesn't it? "That's why I can't get too worked up over this," said Menser. "I mean, I've thought about this sport that way many times. God, that's getting existential." Even weeks after, Menser remains placid about the matter. There's no trace of bitter disappointment, almost an understanding. What a comeback Roy Callender has made. He had been a top bodybuilder when he was living in England in the late 60s and early 70s. In 1971, he got out of the game to become a pro wrestler, and shortly after he moved to Canada, touring the country as a wrestling Mr. Universe. He had won Mr. Europe, Mr. United Kingdom, and his class in the universe in the days when the IFBB had an overall winner. Now he is indisputably the best middleweight in the world. But when he is at his best, he is a heavyweight, and he's one of the best in that class too. Callender lives in Montreal, trains at Caruso Studio under the personal supervision of Jimmy himself. But if you observe the two, it seems to be more than just a student-teacher bond. Callender is no moron. He's been training with weights for some time, and he knows what it takes to develop a physique. So what's so special about Jimmy? I came into his gym about 6 or 7 months ago, and there were guys who had been training for only a year that looked better than me, remembers Roy, native of Barbados and now a citizen of Canada. Last year in Montreal, when the universe was there, Arnold was teasing me about how bad I looked. It kind of got to me. That's what made me get back into it. Well, I went to Jimmy and I told him my plans, and he said that if he was to coach me, it has to be total loyalty. I had to stick to his program 100%. Without question, Callender is better now than he's ever been. His greatest improvement is definition. Couple his once revered mass with cuts, and an awesome specimen is born. The first contest in Callender's comeback was the Canadian Bodybuilding Championships in Calgary last September. It was a convincing win for Roy, who upon being named the winner broke down in a fit of crying. But they were tears of joy, if anything. At the Mr. International contest in Columbus, Ohio, Roy won the heavyweight class and again shed a few tears. But there was no crying in Nîmes. Callender spent most of his time up on the victory podium trying to coax Caruso up there with him, and Jimmy was hardly prepared to do that. He may have had a hair out of place, and that would never do. Callender beat the tremendous Darcy Beckles of Barbados for the title. One cannot help but feel sorry for Beckles. In past years, he's competed as a heavyweight, and in the eyes of many people, he deserved to win that class in 1976, but instead was picked second. So for the Nîmes event, he purposely shed weight to compete in the middleweights, in which certain victory seemed waiting. But of course, he had never reckoned for Callender. But then Callender had originally intended on competing as a heavyweight, and he arrived in France weighing 205 pounds. On the advice of Caruso, he starved for 3 days, and he just made the limit. When State called Callender to the scale for the official weigh-in, Roy unabashedly dropped his drawers and took the stand starkers. "No, no, no," exclaimed State, a half-grin working at his mouth. "I don't have my trunks here." "Well, get some. You can't weigh in like that." It was hard to imagine Beckles weighing less than 198 pounds. He looks much taller than he is, and he's a mother for size. When he hits the front double bicep pose, the arms are understandably incredible, but it's the lift in his pecs and the flare of his lats that really captures the attention. This time out, Darcy was ripped. Both Callender and he are awesome in the same places, back, chest, and arms. To see them pose side by side is indeed a confrontation of the titans. Beckles has got to be thinking what a guy has to do to win these things. Verily, the extreme dejection oozed from Darcy's face upon the announcement of Callender's triumph. At the big banquet later, Callender held forth at the end with a long table laden with French pastries and a whole eyeful of other gourmet evils that had not been a part of Roy's diet, for he said, "Too long. The last 2 days of severe fasting have been taxing for Callender. There's nothing quite as ominous as a man who loves to eat being forced to fast and then on the brink of a serious eating binge." It's hard to compliment Callender. One can praise him up and down only to hear, "Oh, come on, be serious." Or, "Where did you hear that?" Caruso had talked before of Callender's lack of confidence in himself, part of the reason why he had turned to Jimmy in the beginning. Callender will admit of a lack of confidence, but victory such as this can only help him. "He's still making mistakes," said Caruso, "especially in his posing, like in the prejudging. Each guy had a time limit for his posing routine. I told Roy over and over that if they ring the bell in the middle of his routine, to go on and finish with his best shots. So what does he do? They ring the bell and he says, 'Oh,' and he turns around and walks off. I mean, I expected Roy to win, but he's going to have to get even better." Peter Stock of Czechoslovakia took third spot in the middleweight class, which marks an improvement of one place over a year before. Again, with a graceful posing routine, Stock proved that his reputation as a great European champion is intact. He seemed pleased with his placing, and he can only improve in the next World Championships in Acapulco, Mexico. There's something about Stock, an ineffable quality, really, that suggests class. His demeanor throughout a contest, especially backstage, promises something of high caliber. Austria's Walter Bubenicek, bigger than ever and obviously getting better, placed fourth. He reasons to be a force of the future. Loftus Roach of Barbados is always impressed. He finished fifth. Mederic Annette of France has one of the finest sets of abdominals in the sport, and his sixth place was cheered to good length. Canada's Henry Cocker was ripped and pleased the crowd with his unusual shoulder dislocate on his back lat spread. Cocker missed making the lightweight class by only a pound and a half after 4 days of starving, going from 177 to 166 and a half. He may have fared better in the other class. The lightweight class was not without its matchup. Actually, the battle waged between winner Danny Padilla and runner-up Mohamed Makawe of Egypt was the best of the contest. It held special implications. In Montreal, Makawe stunned everyone, superstar that he is, and he upset Padilla for the world championship. Padilla wanted Makawe badly. He had a score to settle, and this time he showed up in the best shape of his life. At a weight of 163, but looking as massive and shapely as ever, he sought sweet revenge over rival Makawe, who came in perfect once more. Padilla simply out-muscled Makawe, who had trained the final month at Gold's Gym in Santa Monica. Neri had come to be good friends with the intelligent Egyptian, and he was worried about being caught up in a battle of sentiments, for Danny, too, was a good friend. It would be best to avoid both men in the days before the event, but that, as expected, proved impossible. Neri had driven some 300 kilometers away from Nice to Nîmes with Padilla and photographer John Balick. Both Balick and Neri were aware that Padilla was in his finest shape. Only a day before, they weighed him in a small pharmacy on a pay scale, and they were confident that he would have no trouble in making the 165-pound limit. Although Padilla's attitude was better, was one of more confidence, it still seemed to lack true conviction. Padilla would tell us how hungry he was, but the words did not carry the weight of a man ready to scrap. Padilla's a fighter. He certainly met the challenge in training as diligently as he did for the contest, but one sensed that he wasn't completely sure about himself, that there was still some more homework to do. But Balick and Neri assured him, and Padilla had asked for no assurance, that judging from what they saw of him, he would beat Makawe. How Neri was the only one who had really seen Makawe. He knew how great he looked. The outcome was a toss-up. How could anyone beat the Makawe he had seen pose over and over so many times in the past 4 weeks? Bigger than ever, up some 7 pounds, and ever ripped. Makawe had expressed a worry that he would be forced into an unfriendly rivalry with Danny. He did not want this. Before the two met in New York a week before the Nîmes event, Makawe said, "I want to spend some time with Danny. I want to be his friend. Sometimes people try to make something out of nothing. We are only sportsmen, and I want to make a good impression on him." The two seemed to hit it off, and on more than one occasion, Padilla would voice his respect for Makawe. "I like the guy. I really do. He's a smart kid. We talked a lot in New York." This would naturally make the competition even better, for now it was simplified to pure sport. It had been a brutal task for Padilla to get overseas from New York. Slated to leave the Sunday before, he was delayed with the Scalax until late Monday, and after an ungodly stretch in the air, they landed in London, where a wait and then a transfer to Paris had to be endured. After sleeping overnight in the Paris airport, not recommended with a low-carbohydrate diet, and dining on burnt eggs, the motley trio finally dragged into Nice after one more flight, some 3 days after they planned to arrive. The capper? The hotel rooms were not available, and after an hour of miserable negotiations and heated phone calls back to New York with the charter people who were to have arranged everything, things were squared away and they hit the sack. Sleeping little, their nerves were shot. So Padilla never really had a chance to enjoy the whole affair. The victory, though a tremendous pleaser, was dimmed a tad with what the giant round around he had been forced into like a flustered rat in a maze. His most common words following the contest, "Just get me home, I'll sleep for a week." The night before the contest, Neri was to join Padilla, Menser, Kathy, and Balick in Danny's room for final applications of instant tanning lotion. On his way up, Neri stopped at Makawe's room, 3 floors below the tanning activity. Makawe was relaxing. He wore a yellow Gold's Gym t-shirt and striped pajama bottoms, and in his hand was a 1-liter Coke bottle from which he took many swigs. "What are you doing with this junk?" asked Neri, somewhat shocked by his alien behavior of Makawe's. "Oh, I need this to pump tomorrow. It gives me energy." "Yeah, but you don't need this stuff. Too much sugar. It can have the wrong effect. Too much of this. You need starches or fruit sugar." "Yeah, I'll eat some fruit tomorrow." Makawe pulled out a large shopping bag of an immense 6-pound brick of chocolate and he bit off a piece. "How do you like this?" Neri stayed for some time and there was much talk of Egypt and Makawe's homesickness for his family. a wife and a 9-month-old son that had haunted him since he left Cairo some 8 weeks before. In 2 days, he would return home, and he was looking as forward to that as the contest. There was a knock at the door. It was Kathy, and she was fuming. "What are you doing?" she wanted to know. "They've been up there waiting for you. You said you were going to help. They're really mad up there. Come on." The battle of sentiments had begun. Neri knew he would be excoriated for spending too much time with Makawe. After all, what country was he supporting? Neri never saw it that way. Upstairs, Padilla had just finished being coated with sudden tan, and his skin carried a healthy bronze hue. Mensah and Padilla were careful to apply the potentially dangerous lotion properly, professionally. Rubber gloves and sponges to smooth out the stuff, keep it from streaking and staining one area too dark, especially the knees and the ankles, and the guy who was applying it certainly didn't want the accompanying nicotine-stained hands, hence the gloves. Coat after coat went on until they both sported skin, brown and braised. The morning of the contest, Padilla still entertained a distant worry about making the weight limit. He held off breakfast until after, but he was sure to save a sweet roll wrapped in a napkin for later. "I made it easy," said Padilla after the weigh-in. After that, he scarfed the jelly roll down with a considerable gusto, and McAway inquired, "Are you hungry enough to be greedy, Danny?" It was a reference to an article in this magazine that had intimated so in the headline. McAway, the champion about to defend his title, wore a bright yellow sweatsuit and a small circle of admirers crowded around him. He seemed calm, smiling much, the face slightly drawn, an indicator that once again his definition would be superior. Padilla had been keeping a lone vigil on the periphery of all this activity in the pumping room. Both men had already been weighed. At one end of the room, State was calling for more lightweights. Padilla produced some oranges from his pocket and offered one to McAway. A mock frown spread over the Egyptian's face. "No, no, no, I don't like that. It gets me fat." And then they all burst out in laughter. At that, McAway pulled out his somewhat smaller brick of chocolate and gnawed a few times. Mensah cast a look of hunger at this escapade and said, "It's so hard for me to walk away from McAway with that chocolate. I want that chocolate." At first observation, it was apparent that Padilla had the superior physique this year, and the competition would be against that and McAway's desire to win. For there is no one who can transmit that hunger for victory like McAway. In the relaxed lineup, one could see Padilla looking over at McAway, checking him out, seeing if he was really as good as he was cracked up to be. In the final pose down that evening, after Padilla had pulled the crowd strongly into his favor, McAway exploded into a spirited series of poses that threatened to draw all attention away from his opponent. Seldom will one see an athlete trying so hard after a title, but in the end, Padilla proved too much this year. Even when Danny raised McAway's arm overhead for a group photo, the Egyptian cramped hard on his abs, making damn sure he would look great, even for the benefit of film. Padilla, however, appeared relaxed, not conscious of how he looked for the photo. For him, the pressure was off. McAway was still trying to win. Outside the theater, waiting for the bus that would take him to the banquet, McAway admitted disappointment, but with his usual sensibility, he said, "I did my best and Danny did his best. I cannot complain. Next year, I'll probably enter the Mr. Olympia. We shall see." Padilla was a tired man after the last pose had been hit. He had little to say, only an immovable smile. He hoped nothing would be written that would get him suspended. Italy's Renato Bertagna looked great in winning third place. He was voted the IFBB's most improved bodybuilder for the year. A veteran of many world championships, Bertagna came in with his finest form. Barbados's Bernard Seely placed fourth, and he was really not that far behind Bertagna. Robert Datlinger of Czechoslovakia earned fifth spot, with Romat Jarami of Singapore trailing him. The intense competition and a great talent made the contest a success. Mr. Albert Placide of the French Federation had his hands full all week in coordinating matters, and in the end, the event came off well. There was no mistaking President Ben Weider's happiness over the contest, which next year will be in Mexico. At a time when delegates, officials, and athletes from some 53 countries congregate at one event and work together for the good of the sport, one knows that bodybuilding is truly moving up. All right. Great article by Jack Neri. Man, I hadn't read that article in a long time. And this was from the March 1978 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. And Jack Neri was such a great writer. And him and Rick Wayne, what a double hit when it comes to great writers in bodybuilding. All right, guys, I got a couple more to go. This is the Mr. Olympia Part 2 report from 1983. MNF's Gonzo journalist pulls out the stops and gets into the soul of bodybuilding's premier competition by Rick Wayne. By 9:45 a.m., the largely European jury was ready to consider who among the year's contenders, conceivably the 15 most ambitious bodybuilders in the world, was most deserving of the designation Mr. Olympia and the $25,000 that went with the honor. Also seated and waiting, if impatiently, were the self-appointed adjudicators, over 4,000 highly charged German fans who would pass judgment not only on the contestants, but also on the men who had sworn to rise above personal prejudices and perform their duty in strict accordance with the prevailing IFBB criteria. Walter van de Breden, Ludwig Nosik, Ron Davies, Michael Heckel, and Jim Mannion. The sole American on the panel, Mannion is chairman of the National Physique Committee in the U.S. Owner and operator of the immensely successful Mannion's Gym in Pittsburgh, he takes his own medicine 6 days a week, sometimes BID, and has experienced firsthand the vicissitudinous existence of the pro bodybuilder, the concomitant mental and physical agony of near-zero-carb diets, life on steroid avenue. Consequently, Mannion is regarded by even the most difficult physique contestants as one of us, and possibly the IFBB's most reliable judge, while several of his less qualified, less popular colleagues see him as a maverick. According to Oscar State, a judge makes one friend a year and lots of enemies, understandably. The last popular Mr. Olympia decision was handed down nearly 5 years ago. From my vantage point, a Mount Everest has been made of what essentially is only a molehill. So much ado about nothing. I have yet to attend a physique contest that wasn't correctly judged within an hour by the audience, insofar as the six finalists were concerned. Yet most contests take up to 4 hours before a decision, usually controversial at that, is reached by the official panel. I'm not suggesting that IFBB events should be decided by the audience, but I am certainly of the view that the current procedure leaves much to be desired. Indeed, it appears to have been designed primarily to accommodate people who live only for that one big day in the spotlight, and I'm not talking about the contenders. As Arnold noted not long ago, no matter how many contenders are on stage, it's no big deal to pick out the best six. After that, it's just a matter of lining up the mothers and then saying, okay, now let's have a lat spread or a side chest or a most muscular. Simple. Well, maybe not quite that simple, but Arnold has a point. Unfortunately, too many Johnny-come-latelys to the business of bodybuilding are dictating the sport's direction. What does Arnold know? One of the breed whose brain is obviously in suspended animation asked me recently. What do audiences know about judging? They're prejudiced anyway. Which suggests that the men who currently judge our contest are both omniscient and devoid of human frailties? Of all our contests, the Mr. Olympia ought to be the easiest to judge. There are seldom more than 20 contenders and just about six truly spectacular physiques to be considered. Yet we're told that the contest is such a difficult proposition that only specially qualified professional judges may sit on the jury. Exactly what qualifies such judges over so-called amateurs is about as easy to fathom as the Red Sea miracle. But let us concentrate on the 1983 Mr. Olympia. The contenders arrived in Munich to discover yet another change in the judging system. Round two had now become round one. How did that come about? Let's hear from the prime mover for change, Oscar State. To the competitors and judges at the Women's Professional World Championship in Calgary, I proposed a change in the judging procedure that I'd been considering for some time. I asked the women if they would like to have round two, which some call the muscularity round, judge first. I pointed out that it would make more sense to start with the compulsory poses after the competitors have been pumping up in the warm-up room, instead of requiring them to stand still and relaxed as the original round one mandates. According to Oscar, the women readily agreed to the experiment, which just naturally made it law by which the men would be judged. Yes, so the first man to be affected by this new system was James Gobert of New Orleans. Shortly before he hit the Olympia Hall stage on the morning of September 24th, at the start of the IFBB's 18th Mr. Olympia contest, Gobert expressed to me the hope that on his first Mr. Olympia outing, he wouldn't find himself outclassed. An asthmatic, Gobert had fought an uphill battle for every inch of muscle he carried, every cut, every bulge. He'd been Mr. New Orleans and 1982 lightweight American bodybuilding champion before successfully taking on the world in Belgium. His journey to the Mr. Olympia stage had taken all but 12 of his 39 years. He weighed 162 pounds, 8 pounds more than at the American Championships, and he was feeling good. In New Orleans, he operated a successful gym with his wife, Lana, who had traveled with him to Munich. Lana always made certain her husband did not suffer the pitfalls of life on the road, that he was never without certain home comforts. She even carried a special skillet so that he wouldn't have to chance his peak condition on unfamiliar food. From my viewpoint, Gobert appeared bigger than he'd been at the American Championships, but even though his posing was as professional as before, his physique lacked the polish that had the audience rooting for him in New York. Yet first impressions were seldom reliable. Johnny Fuller was next. Larger than he'd been on his last night of the Champions outing nearly 6 months earlier, Johnny reminded me of what the Italian reporter Oriana Fallaci had written after a meeting with Sammy Davis Jr. and his then-wife, Mai Britt. Perhaps next to Mai, who was so beautiful, made him look even uglier, so small and skinny and twisted, with his huge nose flattened by punches, his mouth that opens wide like a pink oven, like the mouth of an ogre, his glass eye that always looks in the same direction while the other looks all around. But a strange thing happened. As the minutes, the hours passed, he grew steadily less ugly until he almost wasn't ugly, and then he wasn't ugly at all, and then he was almost beautiful, and then beautiful. He was beautiful in his ingenuousness, his honesty, his optimism. Johnny's nobody's Belafonte, nobody's Burt Reynolds. Lord knows I've subjected him to all kinds of unkind quips. The latest, here comes Johnny Rivolta, referred to as publicized penchant for discos. But a more beautiful guy, once you've got to know him, you'd be hard-pressed to find. His open admiration of some of the younger contenders in the 83 Olympia made him an anachronism in this sometimes snake-infested pit we call competitive bodybuilding. At 48, the former boxing champion displays an altogether unique body. No other bodybuilder on the contest circuit is as rugged, compact, and reminiscent of a rhino in his prime. You'd be a fool to bet against him if Johnny said he could knock down London's St. Paul's Cathedral with his bare fist. The Britisher has been living in Tucson, Arizona for some time now, and it seems the new environment has done him nothing but good. If he is still not cover material for Muscle and Fitness, there can be no denying that he has what turns on the fans. In Germany, he had them shouting for more, just as they've done time after time in Sweden, New York, Australia, London, and wherever freaky muscle is appreciated. Ed Corney was a surprise. Now completely gray, Ed served his specialty to the delight of his fans. What no one expected was the tight young body that accompanied the impeccable movements. Earlier, when I asked how it felt to watch from the wings of semi-retirement, as others aped his style, some commendably, the master laughed. Oh, he said, the fans have never been fooled. They know the real thing. He was right, judging by the warm reception he received, even though he was 5 pounds over his best form. I'd been warned to expect a new Hubert Metz. He came on with a new nose, improved following his recent auto accident, and new pecs, now free of telltale bitch tits. He displayed some of the deepest, sharpest cuts it's been my privilege to see on a heavyweight. However, his face remained expressionless, and that gave the impression that his soul lacked the fire of a serious Mr. Olympia contender. Francis Jacques Nouville was his own judge and jury in London when he sentenced himself to sit with the boys and not with the men of the 1982 Mr. Olympia. I am not ready for them, he told me, but next year. He kept his word. In Munich, he reminded of a younger, more thickly muscled Frank Zane. Jacques' lat spread was challenged by only one other of the 14 contenders. Mohamed Makawe certainly has a way with audiences. He can turn them on with just a smile, regardless of whether or not they are wild New Yorkers, reserved Englishmen, or ostensibly regimented Germans. He also has a way with the IFBB's mandatory poses that lets him rise above the fact of his mini stature and less than 160 pounds. Damn it, I might as well admit it. If I was competing today, I'd consider taking a gun to the Egyptian. Muscles alone wouldn't be enough to deter him. He is cut even between his fingers, yet he carries enough mass to block out the path of heavyweights. Frank Zane looked worn out, which hardly surprised me. Like Frank, I traveled to Munich just 2 days before the contest, and I knew how it felt to function by a body clock that was 9 hours out of sync. And that's not taking into account the psychological and physical stress that's part and parcel of big time competition. No wonder Frank fell asleep in the warm up room. As usual, his stage movements were flawless, if unsupported by the normally dazzling Zane cuts and striations. Then again, one couldn't help remembering that he had pulled the Mr. Olympia title out of worse predicaments. If he wasn't exactly dynamite in the first round, one was nevertheless reluctant to dismiss him. There was more than one way to rope a dope. An aging Muhammad Ali had made an indelible point in his fight with George Foreman. The Mr. Olympia was yet young, even though Frank clearly was not. Francis Gerard Benoit was cut, but in rather strange pieces. His fate was predictable. Not so predictable was Lee Haney's. At over 6 feet, he stood to make tidal waves at his Mr. Olympia debut. One of the most well-liked, best-mannered champions of our time, at breakfast in London, he was heard to address Oscar State as Sir, which I've been assured is less obsequious than Southern gentleman. Lee came on to uplifting shouts from a truly appreciative audience. Just 23, he is most definitely bodybuilding's Lemuel Gulliver. His lat spread put Neville's in the shade, maybe because Lee was lit up by an equally expansive smile. "Go, Haney," shouted Shirley, his blushing bride of 4 months. "All right, Cheryl, let's say you'll be blushing if you could." But Lee stayed long enough to bomb attendant minds with back spreads from here to eternity, catacombed intercostals, thighs that brought to mind the young Oliva, and poses that made the mandatories look like a Haney IFBB conspiracy. Yosef Wilkosh followed that. The night before, at a beer hall kept alive, not by Artie Zeller's corn, not by the pounding disco beat, but by Yosef's wife Ruth's house party affability. Yosef told me that he didn't expect much from the Mr. Olympia judges. He was disturbed by the current bodybuilding fashion. "I'm no Philistine," he said through Zeller's German-English translation. "My wife and I love a night at the ballet, but in a bodybuilding contest, especially the Mr. Olympia, I want to see what every fan wants to see. Big, manly muscle." Yosef's interpretation of the mandatory poses did not conjure visions of Lincoln Center. The name it brought to mind was Hercules. I'd seen Yosef's pictures by Zeller, taken during a recent exhibition in Hawaii, and so anticipated some improvement in the German's physique. But I wasn't quite prepared for his new abdominals, his new shoulders and pecs, and his fluid posing routine, put together with a little help from his friend Ed Corney. Yosef's thighs were a little off, however. Maybe troublesome knees were the problem. They made heavy lower body work torture. From the moment a handsome Samir Banud appeared, he had the women of the Olympia Hall eating out of his hand. What's more, their men were equally crazy about the Lion of Lebanon. From my point of view, he wasn't quite as cut as he'd been in London. Then again, neither was Makawe. However, Samir was equipped for trouble. Massive, beautifully shaped arms and deltoids, impeccable abdominals, tiny waist, and legs that came straight out of nature's private stock. Presumably, Lance Dreyer came to Munich for the experience, while Albert Beckles displayed his usual equipment, still awesome after all these years. Bertel Fox was as massive as he's been for 5 years, with pecs heavy enough to guarantee that if he ever falls, it won't be on his arse. His arms are larger than most thighs you'd encounter on a football field. As you might expect, no ordinary set of underpinning could support Bertel's incredibly muscled upper body. What passes for his legs wouldn't be out of place among Big Sur's Redwoods. The fans never waited for his appearance. They started to chant the minute his name came out over the loudspeakers. Fox, 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 an ominous sound. He offered his version of the mandatories, gritted his teeth, smiled once or twice, and then walked off with the day's first ovation. The man who feared he might not make the top 10 at the end of the day was last on stage. The middleweight winner of the 82 World Championships, Dale Ruplinger, might easily have won a Mr. Congeniality Award had one been up on the line. Everywhere he went, he lit up his surroundings with a smile. That smile was still evident on stage throughout the first round, although somewhat frozen. He would say later that his biggest problem during the contest was keeping cool. No matter, Dale was impressive, but the finishing line was still a long way off. During the intermission that followed Ruplinger's determined efforts, I asked Tom Platz how he thought the contest would turn out. He said first Zane, then McAway and Banut. Franz Mueller, the near 7-foot scourge of the 82 European Championships, offered his own hit parade. Zane, Haney, Banut. Then he added, but I am a liar. Methinks Mueller wasn't the only fabricator at the Olympia Hall. Question. Do pro bodybuilders who depend on their livelihood for the right public image want the world to know they place last for Mr. Olympia? Do also-rans really mean it when they say, hey, it was an honor just to be there? I mean, really? Question. Does it matter that much where a contender places in a pro event if it's out of the money-yielding finals? It seems to me that the pro bodybuilders would be better left with his dignity intact, thinking that he probably placed 7th out of 22. Self-delusion? So what? If promoters and fans don't know for certain that the contender placed last, he might still be capable of commanding respectable fees. Who needs number 12 or number 15 when he can have his pick from among number 1 through number 10 for exhibitions and seminars? Food for thought, perhaps. In Munich, the ritual comparison served to underscore what was known from the first 30 minutes of the Mr. Olympia contest, that Lee Haney, Bertil Fox, Muhammad Makawe, Samir Banute, Johnny Fuller, Josef Wilkosch, and Frank Zane were the main contenders. That the rest, even Mr. Universe winners, were, in this Mr. Olympia, little more than excess baggage. It was much more fun watching the free posing round, maybe because it offered some surprises. Muhammad Makawe was certainly the main man here, if all you concerned yourself was his wizardry. When Makawe is posing, you tend only to see his truly ineffable biceps and triceps, his breathtaking waist and abdominals, his inspiring countenance, not his lack of density, underdeveloped thigh biceps and lower back, so obvious in the earlier round. The Egyptian really does not require musical accompaniment. He is himself a Bach symphony. Compared to his stage presentation, what Ed Corney does is almost corny, which is not so much a put-down of the old master as it is a measure of McAway's unapproached standard. Which is not to say Samir Banute is a slouch. On his Munich showing, he displayed the mass definition and symmetry and the he-manness that were once expected of champion bodybuilders and which in recent times has become secondary considerations. Where are you, Mike Mentzer, now that we are finally agreed? Samir served to remind me that the Mr. Olympia contest is still an event to celebrate might and muscle, not an athletic affair performed by the stars of ballet. Likewise, Lee Haney, who had come a long way since his first New York adventure in 82, Lee appeared to be enjoying himself on stage. In future, he would do better to concentrate less on his funky music and more on effectively displaying his unique physique. In the free posing round, Lee offered only glimpses of his undeniable muscularity. While he moved like Rick James, Lee's almost totally relaxed lower back, pecs, and thighs reminded of Al Green. Bertil Fox proved again that what Mr. Olympia fans really want are big, cut, freaky muscles, not funk. No one can reasonably accuse this brother of being graceful. Oh, but never let it be said that Bertil came to the 83 Mr. Olympia unprepared. Even his exhalations were muscular. The house caught fire when he appeared. Erupted as he foxtrotted to the platform and blazed unabated through his posing routine. As Bertil walked off, he turned around, pointed toward the judges, and said, "Take that. Attaboy, Foxy." Jacques Neuville was impressive. Fuller seemed bothered by the fact that he wasn't called out for more comparisons, as if that were a clear indication that he'd been registered the bottom of the pile even before the action was in full swing. He posed well, but without his usual joie de vivre. What's there to say about my friend and contemporary Frank Zane? That he's big enough to know it really wasn't his day? Is anyone ever that big? Without a doubt, Frank offered still another glimpse of possibly the finest shape ever to grace a bodybuilding stage. His posing, as always, was unique, but every move he made reminded me of Sir Frank, Frank the Impeccable, Frank the Peerless, Frank, who was not with us that night. The preliminaries ended at 1:30 p.m., During lunch at the Hilton, one learned that Samir Banute was suffering severe abdominal pains and was being ministered to by Mike Mentzer. Much later, the doctor would say his patient's problem had something to do with aspirin. Ah, well. The muscle part of the Olympia show did not go on until way after 9 p.m. The earlier time was taken up by German dignitaries making German speeches for German consumption. A German comic had a rough time before finally working his way out of his clothes and into the hearts of the tormentors. It was touching to watch Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, and Albert Busick at the mic. Less than two decades ago, all three were poor slobs like you and me, and the employ of a German magazine publisher whose love for the Deutschmark wasn't nearly commensurate with his love of bodybuilding. Today, Busick is a successful publisher in his own right, and we all know that for Arnold and Franco, the American dream is anything but a dream. Needless to say, Arnold had the audience rolling in the aisles with his references to German ass. When it comes to class, color the Austrian oaf barbarian blue. Deserving of special mention is Ross Robot Man Testo, who made his Mr. Olympia debut in Columbus 2 years ago and has come a long way indeed. In Munich, this mime artist brought the house down with his bodybuilder-oriented act, and he was forced to give an encore. The Mr. Olympia contenders went over what they'd done in the last round of the preliminaries with similar results. The fans went crazy for Bertle Fox. They were happy when Oscar Staite announced the six finalists: Lee Haney, Mohamed Makawe, Yosef Wilkosh, Samir Banut, Frank Zane, and Bertle. During the pose down, they blew up the dam in their enthusiasm for the last mentioned, which must have pressed the panic buttons in the minds of the judges when it was too late to do anything significant. Why? Because Fox had the most muscle, whether or not it met the demands of the trendsetters. Where the fans were concerned, Bertle had exactly what was required to win the Mr. Olympia title. When Oscar Staite announced that in the opinion of the judges, Fox deserved nothing better than fifth place, one spot ahead of Wilkosh, the house lost all interest in the rest of the show. Throughout announcements that Zane, Haney, and Makawe had come out fourth, third, and second, the audience behaved as if it was planned to lay waste at Olympia Hall. Not that they considered Banut unworthy of the Mr. Olympia title. The audience did not actually hiss at the judges' choices. Rather, there was something in their noise that suggested the whole Mr. Olympia contest had been, whole Mr. Olympia concept had been betrayed. A similar attitude, suppressed though it was, greeted Zane's first Mr. Olympia victory. Zane had set a new fashion. He brought an end to the lengthy Scott Sergio Schwarzenegger scenario, and not all bodybuilding fans were ready for the new image. If in the end Zane became acceptable, if in the process he opened the door for the Makawes and the Banuts, Germany was clearly not among those who had moved away from Joe Weider's original concept of what Mr. Olympia should look like. Germany wanted the title to remain synonymous with mass and cuts. Posing ability was to be admired, but not so much that it might make or break a Mr. Olympia contender. So even though Germany respected Makawe and Banut for what they had, that was not enough by the German yardstick to put them ahead of Bertle Fox, who was the nearest thing to Sergio Oliva. But Germany wasn't judging the contest. Those who performed that particular task said Samir was the winner, and that was that. Long after the ritual picture taking, long after the other contenders had left the theater, the larger part of the audience waited behind to hear the new Mr. Olympia give thanks to various supporters. And when he asked if they wished to see him pose again, a unanimous "yah" rose from the floor. Samir obliged, of course. So ended the 18th Mr. Olympia contest, the most exciting in a long time. Promoter Albert Busack earned much praise from visitors and locals alike, including judges and members of the press. The banquet that followed the contest might have done the Roman emperors proud. No promoter before Busack ever went for such lengths to make life easy for his guest. Arnold gets the last word. "Had I been a judge," he told me after the contest, "I'd have picked Fox." But the judges were hamstrung by the current IFBB criteria, which left them no other choice but to pick Samir. Certainly by the present rules, Samir fully deserved victory. En route to the Hilton, the Lion of Lebanon, aglow with his triumph, was wearing sheep's clothing. He apologized to Oscar Staite for his outburst a day earlier, blamed it on low blood sugar and shattered nerves. He had good words for Zane, Haney, and the other contenders. The time seemed opportune to launch a probe, so I said, "What have you got in the case, Samir?" He looked up, and for an instant, I thought he was about to give. Instead, he said, "Someone's taking care of it for me." And then he went to sleep. I never discovered who'd taken over his case, nor did I discover its contents. What the hell? All right. Great article. That was from the March 1984 issue of Muscle and Fitness. And that was part two of the 1983 Mr. Olympia report, written by our favorite writer, Rick Wayne. All right, guys, if you're still with me, I got a couple more to read. I want to make this podcast worth listening to. This also comes from Muscle and Fitness. It's from the June 1984 issue. And I got to say, the Muscle and Fitnesses this year or around this time were amazing. They were beautifully put together magazines, great pictures, great articles. I still had Rick Wayne working for the magazine. Jack Neary no longer was, but he had some other great writers in there as well. And the competition was great. You know, this is a decade of, or the time, I should say, of Samir and McAway and Bertel Fox. Frank Zane was still competing. Lee Haney was just starting to come up. You had the great amateur champions like Bob Paris and Mike Christian, Rich Gaspari, Gary Stridham. Really, really great stuff. All right, so this one is about Rachel McLish, my favorite female bodybuilder. If you guys listen to the show, you know I loved Rachel McLish, as a lot of us did. And this was written by Rick Wayne. So I had asked Rick when we did our interview about Rachel a little bit, but he didn't really say much. So I saw this article, and it's a really full-length article, so I wanted to read it to find out what Rick wrote about Rachel McLish. The name of the article is "Oh My Gosh, It's Really Rachel McLish" by Rick Wayne. It's all there in her hot-off-the-press photo album. When it comes to assessing women's bodies, it seems judges will bend over backwards to accommodate bulk. On the other hand, others insist on an appearance that's streamlined. Oh, but when the two schools of thought come together, a generally preferred new standard emerges. Buzz off, glowworm. Hello, Madam Butterfly. Meekness has nothing to do with it, nor has sex. When the new standard turns the other cheek, it's only to offer paying voyeurs, coveters, and straight bodybuilding fans a palpable slice of the fantasy that is Rachel. Rachel McLish, that is. Who readily admits that she loves being the standard, whether it's to show a parallel or a contrast where body types are concerned. Rachel McLish, born Texan, born again Christian, who dumped a former boyfriend by his own account for God, who wouldn't dream of doing a centerfold for Playboy. My gosh, not if they offered $1 million. That Rachel. At the 1981 American Women's Bodybuilding Championships in Las Vegas, when she vavoomed across a purposefully lit up Caesar's Palace stage in cowboy boots and suede frilly frillies, spandex gluteus maximus pridefully generating enough heat to crepitate the velveteen walls of the Circus Maximus showroom. When she galvanized the wall-to-wall panters with her limpid, don't you think I'm sexy, Linda Ronstadt eyes. When she kookachooed, my gosh, someone said my pants look as if I painted them on. Know what? I did. She wasn't trying to be sexy. Gosh almighty, if there's one thing that's guaranteed to turn Rachel off, it's someone trying to be sexy. Not that she minds being a sex symbol, you understand. After all, the whole thing is out of her hands, totally dependent on the individual's perception of her. Indeed, her pictures and public image notwithstanding, Rachel is merely attempting to do something positive for people who are interested in good health and good looks. It's all there in an interview she granted a few months ago for Women's Sports. When she's posing with open mouth liberally anointed with blood red cream for Harry Langdon's superstar Nikon, when she's working hard for the bread and a boisterous pose down with the toughest ladies of the IFBB's Big Bucks contest circuit, when she sashays past Lee Majors in that drink commercial purring, suck it in, the only thought in righteous Rachel's head is, do it right, believe it or not. Says Rachel, who sees Rachel as a woman committed to doing things the right way, the line is self-explanatory. Right is right, period. Joe Weider speaks here. Rachel is a wonderful advertisement for women's bodybuilding and for our sport in general. She projects an innocence reminiscent of the young Brigitte Bardot. Rachel has an incredibly attractive, sensuous body, but she never flaunts it. Rachel's always natural. Reader, I fear Vanity Fair may be turning good buddy into an artsy fartsy. Alas and alack, for once the Weider view is not universally endorsed. Some of the contenders in the 1980 Miss Olympia event, sore losers, be it said, complained in camera after Rachel's victory that what she carried in her bra during the contest was neither innocent nor natural. But then it wasn't the first time that Rachel's enhanced feminine attributes had been criticized. By her own account, after she won the 1980 U.S. Women's Bodybuilding Championships, some people complained that she was too feminine. Rachel Elizondo was born 27 years ago in the southern Texas community of Harlington. Her father is of Spanish, Irish, and German stock. Her mother, a scintillating mix of Apache and Mexican. When Rachel was quite young, she and her older sister Yolanda lifted weights in the backyard with their daddy, a proud, aggressive man who insists that his famous daughter took after him, never mind that she says her genetics are just like my mother's. In high school, Rachel was a cheerleader and on the dance team. She continued her dance activities for 10 years after graduation. It wasn't until she entered Pan American University in Edinburgh, Texas, majoring in physical education, and found her body succumbing to the relatively sedentary existence of academia that Rachel saw the need to join a health spa. By her recollection, she fell in love with the gym atmosphere and the machinery at her first visit. Her enthusiasm paid off quickly, physically and otherwise. She was made an instructor and then a manager. Before long, she was also co-owner with major shares in two similar establishments. Indeed, it was to gain publicity for the three gyms that she entered her first bodybuilding event, the 1980 U.S. Women's Championships. That same year, she also entered the Zane Women's Invitational, taking second place to the then-hot Stacey Bentley. Somehow, Rachel found time to marry. Then came the groundbreaking 1980 Miss Olympia contest, staged amidst much TV and print hoopla by George Schneider in Philadelphia. Winning that event changed my life, Rachel has told reporters on five continents. If the title brought meows from competitors who suggested Rachel's victory had less to do with her decidedly TNA performance than with the fact that she was also under contract to Dynacam, the event's main sponsor, it also invested Rachel with an exploitable notoriety that spawned lucrative contracts from entrepreneurs at home and abroad. Rachel toured the world. She appeared on the covers of numerous magazines, not all connected with bodybuilding. When a reporter asked what effect the then largely male adulation was having on her young marriage, Rachel gushed, "My gosh, I never forget that I'm a married woman. My husband just loves what's happening to me. He's most supportive. He's always telling me to go all the way." However, at the 81 Miss Olympia, she did not go all the way. Kiki Aloma did, and left Rachel in second place. She blamed that failure on success, said it had left her with little time for contest preparations. She had planned to compete at a body weight of 120 pounds, 1 pound heavier than she'd been the previous year. But she showed up weighing 124, by her measure, definitely too heavy, a consequence of having eaten something that made her body retain too much water. But in defeat, she was magnanimous. She told one reporter, "I wasn't pleased with the way I looked. I really feel like second place was a gift. I was very overweight and genuinely felt I deserved a place even lower." Her victory in the Las Vegas World Championships was small consolation. Ah, but regaining her Miss Olympia status in 1982, despite Carla Dunlap's intimidating opposition, was a joy. Rachel was expected to defend her title, but the following year, the contest went on in Warminster, Pennsylvania, without her. To the beat of Prince's 1999, Carla flash-danced her way ahead of everyone else into the heart of an international judging panel, amidst persistent rumors that Rachel was saving herself for another contest. Also making the rounds was a story, always told with a smirk, that the promoters and Rachel had an agreement that would guarantee her a cool 10 grand up front, and God alone knows whatever else. So now, welcome to the city of spills, steals, and deals. Welcome to Las Vegas. Welcome to Caesar's Palace, with its blazing marquee proclaiming this 10th day in December 1983, Pumping Iron Day. Say hi to Tina Plackinger, 1982 AAU Miss America, Ingar Zitterquist, 1983 Swedish, European, and World Champion, third place winner in the 83 Miss Olympia, Gladys Portuguese, glamorous part-time model and Night of the Champions winner, Carolyn Cheshire, British bodybuilding champion, Lisser Frost Larson, Nordic champion. Sherry Atten, Canada's women's champion. Rachel McLish, twice Miss Olympia. Carla Dunlap, the current Miss Olympia. Lori Birdsong, model and actress from Dallas. Mario Saline, 1981 Finnish women's champion. Shelley Gruwell, 1981 World Grand Prix champion. Lori Bowen, 1983 American champion. And Bev Francis of Melbourne, Australia, a 28-year-old newcomer to bodybuilding, but not a novice to world-class competition. Considered at 181 pounds the world's strongest woman, Beverly has squatted with over 400 pounds. For 4 years, she has been, not surprisingly, world's powerlifting champion. For the purposes of the Caesars World Cup, she has shed 40 pounds and will do battle today at an unbelievably taut, compressed 140. The ladies have all come to Vegas at the invitation of Charles Gaines and George Butler, producers of the contest and the movie Pumping Iron 2, The Women. For months, the Caesars World Cup has been the talk of bodybuilding. Wayne D'Amelia, a big noise in the IFBB with a financial interest in the Gaines-Butler movie, has seen to it that nearly every muscle magazine carried a story on the event. Now at 8:30 p.m., D'Amelia is at the mic with an important announcement for the packed Circus Maximus showroom. As you can see, he says, we're filming a movie here tonight, Pumping Iron 2. Do not use flashes with your cameras. The lighting is adequate. Now let's have a warm welcome for the man you've seen on television, George Plimpton. Had the venue been anywhere else, D'Amelia might have said, for the author of Shadowbox, Paper Lion, etc. But this was Vegas. Over enthusiastic applause, Plimpton gingerly followed his script. Welcome to Caesar's Palace, ladies and gentlemen, and to the richest women's bodybuilding contest of all time, the Caesar's World Cup. Total prize money, $50,000. The winner will walk off with $25,000, and I might add, this is equivalent to the largest prize ever offered in any bodybuilding event, male or female. It would be no easy night for Plimpton, by George. He introduced IFBB President Ben Weider, who welcomed the up to 50 bucks a seat audience, then declared the proceedings officially open. As has been the practice for several years at IFBB-sponsored events, the preliminaries have been held earlier in the day. Contenders have been judged according to their symmetry, muscularity, and so on. And right from the start, it was clear that in her midsection alone, Bev Francis showed more muscle than was evident among the other women in some. Conceivably, at the end of the day, she would come out either ahead of everyone else or behind them. Simply, among the other aspirants, Bev Francis was as much an anachronism as indeed Plimpton was among the backstage help. Just a few weeks earlier, the IFBB had issued a directive to its judges ordering them not to choose women with too much muscle. The Federation did not actually spell it out, but the implied warning was clear. No women who look like men. Writing in Psychology Today a month prior to the Vegas contest, Charles Gaines had noted, it is widely believed among the powers that be that real muscles on women, the unequivocal bulging kind ordinarily associated with men, are not salable in America. People may pay once out of curiosity to see those kinds of muscles on women, but they will not continue to pay. Such women, Gaines went on, are featured less and less in the magazines that report and advertise the sport. Women's bodybuilding is now almost totally represented by slim, pretty women on whom muscles do not show until they are flexed, women with whom American women will want to identify. Moreover, if female bodybuilding is to flourish, it will have to address the deeper question of what the sport and art of women's bodybuilding are all about. Are they about the unhindered development and competition of female muscles? Though a majority of the present promoters appear to find that option unsettling, they may soon well be stuck with having to make the best of it. Very soon indeed. Immediately following the afternoon preliminaries, Rachel McLish said she was competing under heavy pressures. Concerning the judges who had compared her side by side with the incredibly muscled Francis, Rachel said, "Gosh, I really think they did that only for the purposes of the movie. They ought to have her put her side right from the opening round and compared the other entries. Obviously, no woman here has her size or muscularity. I think she was invited just to portray the extreme in female bodybuilding." That evening, immediately after Carla Dunlap had been declared overall winner of the $25,000 Caesars Cup, Bev Francis took eighth. A dejected but composed Rachel said there had been complaints about her hairstyle and posing suit. The show had started 30 minutes behind schedule, because the judges insisted on examining her bra for UFOs, unspecified foreign objects. When she had changed into her pantsuit, I joined Rachel at a table at the Circus Maximus. Also at the table was her Austrian boyfriend, herpetologist, karate expert, and bodybuilding champ Christian Janach, and E. Jean Carroll, Playboy representative, was working on a book about women who act strange. I said, "Rachel, did my eyes deceive me, or were those really Rachel McLish clones on stage this evening?" "Interesting question," noted Playboy's woman. Rachel said yes, several contestants had employed her posing style. One had actually asked Rachel if she minded, and Rachel said no. She considered it a compliment. Playboy's woman said, "Before you, Rachel, the poor dears had no one to copy. All they had were the male bodybuilders." Her nose crinkled. had it been especially difficult competing, as it were, with herself, with people who felt they had improved the McLish style? I thought the style was perfect without the sleaze, said the originator. As I was telling Jean earlier, when I do my stage routine, I make a point of never bumping and grinding. I don't want to take sexy poses. If I exude sensuality, well, it's something from within, nothing I achieve by a gesture. But you must be aware of the effect on your audience, said Playboy's woman. You're one sexy lady. I read my fan mail, Rachel said. Much of it is sex-oriented. Sure enough, I appreciate it. He, Janich, chuckles because this is something he's always known. I mean, that I could pose in a paper bag and still come. Absolutely, spurted Playboy's woman prematurely. Rachel went on, and still come off exuding sensuality. I reminded her of an appearance in Atlantic City when she shared a stage at the Playboy Club with that well-known barbarian, Arnold Schwarzenegger. At one point during their performance, after a particularly well-endowed World Cup contender had lifted the house to its feet, Arnold took the mic and said, "So you think that was exciting? Let me tell you, I was standing backstage with my face this close to Rachel's ass. Believe me, that's exciting." When Rachel tried to counter, the brute pointed at a cigar-shaped mic in her hand. "Ooh," he moaned. "Don't you just love the way she holds that thing?" The house broke up. Still later, Arnold took another swipe at Rachel's sex symbol image. "You've been a wonderful audience," he said, straight-laced. "Now I want you to be the first to know Rachel will star in my next movie." He let the applause die down. "The movie is called Deep Throat 3. In Vegas, there was no Arnold to contend with. You have to admit his comments were raunchy, impolite, Rachel said. "I think he made a fool of himself. I wasn't about to stoop to his level. He really doesn't know better. All I said in Atlantic City was, ladies and gentlemen, here you have the real Arnold." Judging by the gleam in her eyes, Playboy's woman approved. But what about the real Rachel? Is she synonymous with the Rachel with the magnetic protuberances? "I know the real Rachel," said Rachel. "My last Muscle and Fitness cover wasn't me. It was the worst. All cheesecake. I said to Joe Weider, oh my gosh, Joe, of all the pictures. I said, the only thing wrong with this particular cover is the guy pictured with Rachel." "My sentiments exactly," said her boyfriend. The devil and Mr. Bone said, "Why won't you do a Playboy centerfold?" She froze. Eyes shooting off panic signals, she said, "Because there's no way anyone's going to buy my integrity. No way. Not for $1 million. I won't even do an on-screen love scene. It just wouldn't be right." Playboy's woman held her peace. To Rachel's real-life lover, I said, "How does it feel to be Adam in Rachel's Eden?" "Not bad at all," he grinned, eyes on the table. "Her personality suits me just fine." "Meaning?" "That her character is, for me anyway, perfect. At all times, I can rely on her. If you can trust someone as I trust Rachel, 100%, you're guaranteed a perfect relationship." Rachel jumped in, all bubbly. "This is the greatest compliment he's ever given me. He told me he's never trusted anyone as much as he trusts me. He's the first person who's ever really appreciated me for, you know, what I am." She had heard the rumors about her having received $10,000 to compete in the Caesars World Cup, plus a guarantee of victory. "Well, obviously something went wrong," she laughed. "I couldn't do better than third place." But seriously, two elements were involved, the contest and the movie. "It's true that I got more money than the other girls for participating in the movie, but only because I happen to have the best contract lawyer in LA working for me. As far as the contest was concerned," he said, "Rachel, that's your affair. The stories must have made it difficult for the judges to look at me objectively." "Ah, well." "How did the other contenders treat her?" "She said a couple had complained to the judges about her posing suit. Finally, she had cut out the damn lining from the bra before going on stage. She didn't want to dwell on that little matter, however. She preferred to believe everybody was nice. Last December, she was quoted by a magazine as having said she didn't consider herself a religious person. In Vegas, she had a change of heart. "I'm a born-again Christian," she told me. "I used to be Catholic until 1980. It wasn't like a big revelation or anything, just a matter of devoting my life to being Christ-like." She accepted the Bible as the word of God and tried her utmost to follow it. It's the most important thing in her life. "Christian wants to get married," she said, "but I won't. I can't. Not until our values parallel. Not until he, you know, only when he feels as strongly about God as I do will I accept him as my husband." As she spoke, a silent Janich nodded pensively. Playboy's woman had another question. "Do you believe in hell?" Sure I do, Rachel whispered. Her lover said, you can't believe in God without believing in hell. Will you go to hell? Asked Playboy's woman. For your sins, I mean. Do you believe that? Rachel said, no. I believe a Christian will be forgiven if she repents. We came back to Earth. What price have you paid for success? I asked. She answered quickly, perhaps too quickly. Her voice was sad. My husband, as you know, I was married for about a year. At first, I thought that was the highest price, but, well, my husband, my ex-husband, has remarried. He's got a child. He's extremely happy. Well, maybe the real sacrifice has been my time. I have no time for myself. Good God, said Playboy's woman. You mean... That's why I bought a place in Woodland Hills, said Rachel. It's relatively quiet up there. I can get up and read the word. A typical day for Rachel McLish begins at 6 a.m. At that time, she puts the kettle on for a cup of tea or coffee and then reads her Bible for half an hour before getting aboard her life cycle to rev up my metabolism for about 20 minutes. After that, it's off to Gold's Gym or World's Gym in Santa Monica for a 90-minute session with the weights. Playboy's woman, who appeared to have a personal interest, asked Rachel if caffeine was good for burning off fat fast. I seldom have more than 2 cups a day, Rachel said. I wouldn't know for certain. She gets down to serious business around 10:30. Phone calls, appointments, acting class, letters. Last year, she traveled to Europe, the South Pacific, Australia, Japan, Singapore. Unlike 1982, Mr. Olympia Chris Dickerson, who was black, Rachel has never appeared in South Africa. She refuses to acknowledge that country, she says. She abhors its racist policies. So what happens after you've opened your mail, asked Playboy's woman. You wandered off. Usually I have a meeting with someone, said Rachel, or a reading. In L.A., that can take up to a whole day. You'll have to get someone to organize these things for you, advised Playboy's woman. You don't have to go to anyone for anything. Let them come to you. I do if I really want a part, Rachel said. Has she ever turned down a role? Only what I consider trash. Recently, she employed someone to help with her mail order business after the overwhelming response to just one ad in Shape she had to. Still, we're behind with the orders, she sighed. In other areas, she was doing much better. TV commercials, training and music videos with Schwarzenegger and Herb Albert, personal appearances, endorsements, book contracts, a small part, Dak DeLass in The Cutting Room, with Burt Reynolds and The Man Who Loved Woman were keeping her accountant smiling. What do you do at night? Asked Playboy's woman. Try to sleep, Rachel said. When do you do your hair, your shopping, your little female things? I shop when I travel. I turned to her boyfriend. Do you get teased a lot? Teased? I mean by guys. Yes, a little. What do they say? They talk about Rachel, but politely. Then they look at me and say, Christian, you lucky dog. And what do you say? I say, yes, I am a lucky dog. All right. Excellent article by Rick Wayne. All right. And we got one more, guys, if you're ready. This is the Arnold Schwarzenegger interview. And this comes from the March 1982 issue of Muscle and Fitness. And it was done by Bill Dobbins. This is a two-part interview where Arnold was promoting the movie Conan. And I think it was done recently after his 1980 Mr. Olympia win. So he talks a lot about his movie career. And it's interesting hearing Arnold talk at this time before his movie career really took off. But this was after he made the movie Conan. So he knew that this was going to be a big opportunity for him and for his life. So the person doing the interview is Bill Dobbins. And it says, the name of Arnold, seven-time winner of the Mr. Olympia, is synonymous with bodybuilding. Many of your fans were surprised when you decided to return to competition by entering the 1980 Mr. Olympia. Arnold, I can believe it. I was a little surprised myself. What does that mean for the future? Can we expect to see Arnold Schwarzenegger in competition again? Arnold, this is not in my foreseeable future. I'll always be a bodybuilder. That's as natural to me as breathing. But I really have no interest in competing at present. Of course, right up until a few months before the 80 Olympia, I would not have thought I would get psyched up to enter the contest. What happened was a kind of instinctive reaction, a coming together of a lot of factors at the same time. It must have been very exciting for you in retirement 5 years and then suddenly back center stage again, winning the Mr. Olympia title, the audience cheering. With all the success and celebrity you've achieved outside bodybuilding, have you found anything to match that kind of thrill? Yes, I found that making movies is a real thrill, not the same as contending for a title, but a very exciting and satisfying activity. In bodybuilding, you go through a long period of preparation with little more than your will and imagination to sustain you. And then you get this super payoff on stage the night of the contest. But movie making is different because it's a series of thrills spaced out over a period of time. First, there's the business deal, negotiating and signing a contract. And then there's a preparation and training. For Conan the Barbarian, that involved everything from horseback riding to sword fighting. After that comes the actual making of the movie itself, the acting, the stunts, working in the studio and on location. Finally, there's promoting the film, going on television, seeing the billboards and advertisements. Reading good reviews can be another thrill, almost like having the judges in a bodybuilding contest vote you the winner on stage. But the actual movie making can be pretty boring, can it? Well, for some people maybe, but not for me. I get very involved in the whole process of making a movie. There's so much you can learn. For example, I'm very interested in producing, so I spend a lot of time with the producer, finding out things like how money is raised to make a movie, how a budget's created, how you go about finding locations, and so on. Or I might watch the makeup artist work and find out how certain illusions are created, like making an actor look as if he'd been beaten up or wounded. So rather than being bored, I find movie making highly stimulating and educational. Except that you have to share the credit. On stage in bodybuilding, there's just you. Yes, that's a tremendous feeling. And you can do without it? Well, I have to admit that I've always wanted to be somebody special. Bodybuilding has been a way of achieving that. But I've always thought of winning contests as a means to an end. Becoming famous was a way to open up greater opportunities for myself. I never intended to spend my whole life as a competitive bodybuilder. Even when I was very young, I knew I wanted to do lots of things and make lots of money. For example, there are thousands of aspiring writers in this country, but winning all those championships has given me a recognition factor with the audience that assures publishers I will be able to sell a lot of books, so I get to write them. Look how many young men and women are desperate to become actors, but they don't make it because there's nothing unique about them, nothing to make them stand out. Because of my physical development, I've been given the opportunity to act. Bodybuilding gave me a chance to get into writing. It gave me the chance to get into acting. And it also got me started in business, first with my mail order business and then real estate. For me, bodybuilding has led inevitably to all these other things, and it wouldn't make sense not to continue doing the things that develop naturally out of my competitive career. You mentioned your interest in making money. How important is that to you? Well, it used to be very important, but now that I've done it, so it isn't a major motivation anymore. Money is now a way of establishing my value in the marketplace. Burt Reynolds doesn't really care whether he gets $1 million or $2 million a film, but he knows Hollywood uses money to keep score as to how big a star you are. And he has to keep his price up if he wants to maintain his standing as a movie star. Clint Eastwood and Sylvester Stallone find out how much he's getting, and then they ask for the same or more. That's the sort of thing I have to do nowadays. In a world that keeps score by money, you have to keep your price up. But once you make over a certain amount, money isn't something you actually spend. It's for playing Monopoly. Bodybuilders have had opportunities for wider success before, but not many of them have ever made anything of them. What makes you different? Well, I'm certainly not unique in that regard. Steve Reeves did really well with his Hercules movies. Reg Park managed to combine a career in bodybuilding with making movies and owning a number of gyms. Franco Colombo has become a doctor of chiropractic and a good businessman. But don't you have a talent for self-promotion that the others don't? Well, it isn't so much a talent as simply knowing that I am great. I am a true champion. That gives me the confidence so that promoting myself becomes easy. Aren't you afraid that will sound awfully egotistical? Oh, just the opposite. Egotism is when you push yourself when you don't deserve it. If you really have ability, if you're really good, it's natural to let people know about it. A lot of individuals who are really good are afraid to say they're good because they think people will believe they're just bragging. I think when you're great, you ought to show it. I'm not in favor of false modesty. The ones who are not great and act as if they are, those are the ones who are egotistical. I believe that you should earn what you get, that being the best means something and it's worth going after. The fact that I'm a great bodybuilder doesn't mean I look down on other human beings. I have close friends who are bodybuilders and some who have never lifted a weight. As far as choosing my friends or giving respect to people who deserve it, whether they have muscles or not is not the criterion I use. But when it comes to competition, to recognizing who's the best in the sport of bodybuilding, I am very much an elitist. Does this sense of yourself as being great make you take yourself too seriously? Not really. I always try to have fun, and you can never take yourself too seriously when you're having fun. Like that time you decided to go shopping in Munich in the middle of a snowstorm wearing nothing but posing trunks? Arnold laughing. Oh, yes, that was for a spread for our German magazine. Again, it was a way of standing out, to be noticed. They had me pose in front of the train station, going shopping, and things like that. Then they had a photographer record people's reactions to me, which were pretty extreme, as you can imagine. This was in the 60s, and the public had even less idea what a bodybuilder looked like back then than they do now. Well, speaking of standing out, probably no single piece of publicity did more for your recognition by the general public than Pumping Iron. How did that project come about? Did you know Charles Gaines and George Butler before they started the project? Or did you meet them when they first came to you with the idea of the book? No, I didn't know them before. I was the reigning champion and they were looking for someone to do the book with. Mike Katz told them I was articulate and a good spokesman for the sport, and they came to see me. With amazing results. Oh, exactly. I think that the three of us meeting was meant to be. It was perfect. We promoted the sport. Gaines and Butler gained a lot of recognition, and the book did wonderful things for my career. Did the success of the book surprise you? Absolutely not. I was convinced from the first that Pumping Iron would be a fantastic success. Well, one thing it did for you was give you opportunity to go on television and be seen by the general public. That was a great opportunity. When I was promoting that book, people got a chance to see that a bodybuilder can be personable, intelligent, and articulate. Since then, a lot of bodybuilders have been booked on talk shows because the producers have learned that they can be really interesting people. But you'd already been famous for a long time in bodybuilding. Was achieving fame in this wider arena very different? Did you have any trouble adjusting to it? Not really. For one thing, it happened so slowly that I had plenty of time to adjust to becoming well-known and achieving wide recognition. And whenever I went out and did promotion for the projects I was involved with, I was also conscious of being a spokesman for bodybuilding and trying to promote the sport at the same time. And this helped keep things in perspective. Man, you make it sound so easy. Being famous must have had more effect on your life than you let on. We read about you in the magazines. We see photos of you with the Kennedy family. Isn't it true that your social horizons have expanded a great deal as a result of your success outside of bodybuilding? Not all that much. I know the Kennedy family through my girlfriend, Maria, who is Teddy Kennedy's niece. Her mother is very much involved with the Special Olympics, and I'm the national strength coach for the program. So I'll attend the opening of Superman 2 in Washington, D.C., because it's a benefit for the Special Olympics. I'm sure I'll attend all the functions involved with the promotion of Conan, but you won't generally find me going to the openings of other people's movies. But there were changes I had to make in my life. In the early 70s, I ran around all day in shorts and a t-shirt. I would never get into a suit. Charles Gaines called me a free spirit. I would say anything that came into my mind. But when I started traveling around the country, promoting books and movies, doing talk shows and attending social events connected with various projects, it became obvious that I would have to dress appropriately and behave in such a way as to bring credit to the sport of bodybuilding. So now instead of two suits in my closet, I've got like 8 or 10, and I'm a little more discreet in public than I used to be. And when you change your behavior like that, don't you change inside as well? Aren't you really quite different than you were, say, when you first came to this country in 1968? Oh, I certainly hope so. I would hate to think I've not grown as a person or learned anything in all these years. But I don't think I've changed outside of the normal evolution that anybody should go through as they get older and more experienced. I have, for instance, learned how to be a better diplomat, but I still know a fool when I see one, even if I don't choose to make my opinion known. When I'm alone with my friends, I'm still the same old Arnold, and I don't plan on ever being anything else. I also have a wider perspective on bodybuilding. For me, it used to be just a way of competing and exercising my own talents. Now I realize how valuable it can be as a means of physical fitness for almost anybody. Well, there is some controversy as to just who that old Arnold is, however. For example, in Rick Wayne's article, Arnold, Saint or Devil, Muscle and Fitness, August 1981, Ricky suggests that a lot of your success was due to your ability to psych out your opponents. Do you object to that characterization? Oh, very much. That article was a complete distortion of what made me a champion. The thing is, there is some degree of psyching out in all sports, but that's done in addition to fully developing your talent, not instead of developing it. And in real life, you can't psych out a producer to get a movie part or psych out Simon & Schuster to get a book contract. You have to show substance. The same thing is true on a bodybuilding stage. To beat Sergio, you'd better have a great physique. In the Saint or Devil article, Ricky left out the Saint part. The years of hard work, the constant studying about every facet of bodybuilding, how I worked to pose better, to master diet, to become as perfect a bodybuilder as humanly possible. Those are the things that got me where I am today. And only a small part of my success had anything to do with psyching anyone out. But Ricky admires you and says he didn't intend that article as criticism. Yeah, but look at the impression it gives. Everyone I talked to about the story has told me, if I didn't know you, I would think you got all your success through tricks and through psychological maneuvering. That's the image you get from that article. But aren't you shown in Pumping Iron teasing Lou Ferrigno and using psychological pressures to get an edge? Perhaps, but the movie also shows that I worked the hardest, that I had the best body, that I would have won no matter what. That's what's wrong with Ricky's article. It doesn't show the complete picture. Besides, Pumping Iron was not a straight documentary. There were many scenes in that movie that were brought in to illustrate certain aspects of bodybuilding. Life in general demands that you be aware of alternative ways of doing things rather than just go charging ahead without thinking. I believe that when you go into a business meeting, for example, or embark on a political campaign, you must have strategy and tactics. I believe the same is true in a bodybuilding contest. But I've never tricked anybody in competition or used malicious and deceitful tactics. What I have achieved in and out of bodybuilding, I've gotten through hard work and using my head. I don't break the rules and I don't engage in unethical conduct. Even in the Olympia in Sydney, there wasn't a move I made that was actually in violation of any rule, no matter what anyone says. Even entering at the last minute without telling anyone? I got an invitation. I accepted it. There was no rule saying when you had to announce you were going to enter. Well, not to overdo these questions, but is it true that one reason you entered the 1980 Olympia was so that you could be in the photos George Butler was shooting for Pumping Iron 2? No. Paul Graham had somebody making a documentary for Australian television, but that's all. Everything else you hear is just untrue. But is there going to be a Pumping Iron 2? There's a book already in preparation by Charles Gaines and George Butler, but it won't be the same as the first book. It'll be what has happened in bodybuilding since 1975. My film career, for example, Louis doing the Hulk TV series, and the development of women's bodybuilding. And George Butler definitely intends to make a second Pumping Iron movie, but the details aren't set yet, and he hasn't gotten all the money together, so I'm not sure when the film will be made. But your films are definitely a factor in your future, aren't they? What are the chances of a whole series of Conan films? Well, if this first movie does well, and it's clear that Conan could well be another Raiders of the Lost Ark, there will definitely be a Conan 2, Conan 3, and so on. As long as my fans continue to come to the films, I'd like them to keep making them. But I think the success of Conan can mean a lot to bodybuilding as well. As far as the public is concerned, whenever they think of bodybuilding, they think of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the reverse is true also. When they see me on the screen, it will increase their awareness and acceptance of bodybuilding in general. This works in favor of the competitors, the promoters, and the magazines as well. And it means that the more young athletes will be drawn into the sport, just like they were in the 50s when Steve Reeves was making movies. So I'd like to see lots of Conan movies made, both to further my own career and to benefit bodybuilding as well. That would be nice, of course, but Hollywood's a rough proposition. Do you really think you can have a movie career to rival your bodybuilding career? Definitely. For example, the money spent on costumes for Conan, on special equipment, the whole way the movie was filmed indicates that the people putting up the money were convinced that this was the first of a series. It shows me that the producers believe I am bankable and I will be a big draw. Nobody puts up money for a film unless they think it'll make a profit. Beyond the possibilities that this movie is for really accelerating your fame and success, you seem to have a special affinity for Conan as an individual. Is this true? I love the role. In the past, I've had lots of opportunities to do things that other people only dream of, stand on stage and be applauded by thousands of people, be the subject of an uncountable number of magazine articles and television interviews, write books, make movies, travel around the world. But somebody like Conan is capable of things that the rest of us can hardly imagine. He uses his mind, his strength, his speed and his courage to conquer a whole world. He's never frustrated. He's not governed by other people's rules. He makes his own rules. It is impossible to live in modern society in that way, so I found it tremendously gratifying to be able to experience that kind of lifestyle playing the part of Conan. In that sense, he is my alter ego, And I look forward to playing him many times in the future. All right, the end. That was part one of the Arnold interview. Maybe one day in the future we will do part two. Really insightful interview with Arnold at a really critical point in his life, right when he was ending his bodybuilding career after competing in his last Mr. Olympia and making his first big movie, which was Conan the Barbarian, which came out in 1982. He made it in 1981, right after the Olympia was over in Australia. All right, guys, thanks for listening to this special episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I hope you enjoyed all the magazine articles that I read. If you guys enjoyed this, please let me know. You can send me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And if you have any suggestions for some future articles you want to hear, let me know that as well. Next week, we should have Jerry Branum back on the show to finish up our end of the year review, where we go back 30 years, 40 years, and 50 years and review the year that just passed. We'll be going back to 1992 this time, because we've already covered 1972 and 1982. So Jerry and I will talk about the year 1992, which was Dorian Yates' first Mr. Olympia win. It was also Kevin Lavroni's first year as a professional. He won the Night of the Champions that year. Vince Taylor won the Arnold Classic that year. And in the amateurs, Flex Wheeler turned pro in 1992, winning the MPC USA. And John Sherman won the MPC Nationals. So a lot to talk about. Really big year in bodybuilding. And hopefully we will have Jerry back next week for part one of our interview on the year 1992. All right, guys, have a great week. Good to be back from Hawaii, and hope you enjoyed the podcast. We will be back next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Until then, train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.